Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. NBC's Chuck Todd joins to discuss the latest political headlines, including the possibly soon-to-be-indicted former president reportedly wanting to be handcuffed. Then we'll open the lines to hear from you about Massachusetts' shrinking public beach access. A homeowner in Rockport is trying to close down public access to Andrews Point, while climate change is already eroding the beaches we do have access to. How much is being able to dip your toes in the sand mean to you, and are you willing to fight for it?
I'm Marjorie Egan. Then Andrew Cabral, former Suffolk County Sheriff and Public Safety Secretary for Massachusetts, weighs in on the bizarre and troubling history of an anti-vax police officer. Among other things, this Boston cop left her post multiple times on duty to follow Mayor Wu around town and protest her vaccine mandates. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The CEO of video sharing app TikTok is facing many questions in a congressional hearing this morning. The U.S. government has warned the Chinese-owned company.
Houston Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim. I hope you're well.
Oh, I am well. Thank you for asking. I hope you're well, too. We're live at the library tomorrow. The Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, joins us for an hour of Ask the Attorney General. That's 1 to 2. We're joined now, though, on the phone by Chuck Todd. Chuck's the political director for NBC News, as well as the moderator of Meet the Press. You can catch that Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. Also co-host Meet the Press Now on NBC Now, and hosts the Chuck Toddcast with new episodes every Wednesday. Hello there, Chuck Todd.
Well, how you doing? Happy Thursday.
And to
Happy
you.
Happy Thursday to you too, Chuck Todd. So the Wall Street Journal is now reporting that this Manhattan grand jury, the one that's supposed to, from which we're supposed
the
to
imminently,
indictment. Yeah, the imminent indictment is dragged on now for weeks. They're supposed to be convening again today. There's a lot of speculation that the last witness before them, an attorney for Donald Trump, shot through the credibility of Michael Cohen, an admitted liar, and that the prosecutors in Manhattan may have gotten nervous about that. And that's why we haven't had any indictment yet. But what do you think is going on in Manhattan?
I think that Donald Trump manufactured a story and most people fell for it. And it wasn't nearly as close as everybody made it seem. I mean, it's really frustrating to watch this when you know what he's doing. You see it happening in real time. You know we're all going to be, this is going to turn out to be Geraldo Rivera's empty cave and Al Capone. And sure enough, it was. I mean, it's sort of like, are you shocked that Donald Trump is full of F? He made this up. And why did he make it up? Because this is the weakest case against him. And he's petrified of the other two cases. What do you do? Donald Trump is one thing he is media savvy about his legal problems.
Right.
The entire premise of Donald Trump's existence is about escaping a legal problem. That's how he has lived his life for the last 40 years, starting with the bankruptcy. Everything is about how does he escape a legal quandary. If it means running for office, he'll run for office. If it means starting a TV show, he'll start a TV show. If it means, creating a fake university, he'll create a fake university. But if you really look at the pattern of his behavior here, and it was like the idea that he said all this, and everybody jumped. The Republican Party, the New York City Press Corps, New York City Police Department, and he did it again. And I'll tell you this, it did convince me of one thing.
What?
If he is living and breathing and running, he's going to win this nomination. The rest of these folks, he bullied Ron DeSantis into defending it. He got the entire House Republicans to debase themselves on this. This was a fascinating power play by Trump. For a man who is politically extraordinarily weak with the middle of the electorate, he did flex some muscles. In some ways, it was an impressive show of influential bullying power.
Wait, I want to be clear where you're going here. Are you suggesting that his brilliant tactics may have convinced Bragg not to proceed with this indictment? Is
no,
that what
I just don't. No, I'm not. I don't know whether that is the case or not. But he knows what he's doing. He's putting Bragg in a no-win. If he does get indicted, he could say it was pressure from the left. If he doesn't, it's going to look like he successfully bullied him. But either way, he took advantage of the weakest case. Look, this is a weak case, right? The single biggest problem with this case is the federal government didn't pursue it,
mm-hmm.
right? The fact that a local DA is pursuing something, a federal crime that was broken, and he's pursuing it and not the feds, unfortunately, I think is the biggest tell, the biggest problem he has with his case.
Well, it's not only the weakest legally, it's the weakest politically. Would you not agree? I mean,
and definitely, definitely. Look, this country has already said, don't come to us with affairs. Mm-hmm. We're done with that.
Yeah.
Don't do it. I mean, how often? And look at these campaign finance cases. I mean, the time is to bring a campaign finance case against somebody. Bob McDonnell in Virginia, John Edwards of North Carolina,
yeah.
and Stevens in Alaska. Every one of those was either overturned or never successfully prosecuted.
So
it makes you wonder about what the half the country is doing regarding their own affairs. That's what you have to wonder after that declaration, Chuck.
But the fact is the campaign finance laws suck. Okay,
yeah.
Congress passed terrible laws that have turned out to be unenforceable.
So assuming this goes ahead, part of his performance art, for lack of a better expression, according to some reports, I don't know how credible they are, you may, is in addition to being fingerprinted and having his mugshot taken, he wants to be handcuffed. I assume tomorrow we'll find out he wants to be gagged, too. So
I thought we had discredited the Steele dossier. Sorry.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere else, but, if you know what I'm referring to, you know.
Yes, that's right. It was a racy document, was it not?
Yeah. A golden star to you.
Exactly.
Golden being the key word, by the way, for those who have to do research on Google as we're speaking. We're speaking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. You know, Chuck, you told us, every time we're talking to someone of your stature and we say, can you help us psychoanalyze this guy? They say, no, I don't do that. But you can't make that excuse because you're the one, I think, told us a few years ago that you spent a weekend looking at YouTube clips of Trump and you concluded something I found really interesting, that you never saw him laugh except
he doesn't naturally laugh
at someone else's expense. So in light of the fact that's sort of
and he doesn't have a dog either.
And that is significant. Psychoanalysis. I think you used the word a minute or two ago that he's terrified of the other cases. Do you see a terrified man who feels that walls that have never closed around him are going to close around him, even if the ones to worry about are not in Manhattan?
Terrified is a strong word. I do think somebody said described him to me once recently, and I thought, oh, I like this one, which is, the reason this was with a Republican consultant, said, and I'm not going to bet against him getting the nomination because he likes standing on cliffs.
Yeah.
He doesn't mind the near-death experiences. So I don't think he's terrified. I think, though, he's self-aware. He knows what he did in both of those cases. He knows they can probably make a case in these other two. And he knows those will be pretty hard to overcome. Those are politically problematic. Being seen as anti-democratic and against the Constitution is unpopular in this country still.
Yeah.
Hopefully it will remain.
Thank God.
And I do think that those two, and they're harder. They're going to be hard. And here's the other thing. I think he knows in Georgia, he's going to, if he gets convicted, he's going to need a pardon from the Republican governor.
I know, that's great.
How's that going to work?
Yeah. That's great.
Good luck. Good luck getting that.
Chuck Todd, let's change the topic here for a minute. You had Elizabeth Warren, our senator, on your show last week talking about banking. And whenever we've had her on talking about anything, I'm always impressed by what a big brain she has and how clearly, like a lot of smart people, they can explain really difficult concepts in a really clear way. But as people know, she had a spark for a while when she ran for president, but she really didn't get anywhere.
She didn't win a primary.
No, she did not. She did not. But there was some enthusiasm for a while, and then it faded fast. Now, a lot of people, because of what Elizabeth Warren did not say about Kamala Harris, that she was sure initially that she should be Joe Biden's running mate. Now we're having a lot of analysis of the sexism, the racism that's involved in getting rid of Kamala Harris, and the sexism that might have been involved in getting rid of Elizabeth Warren. But I just wonder what you make of this whole thing about both the sexism involving both women and the sexism and racism with Kamala Harris, or is it just that they were not candidates that were good enough for most of America?
Well, you know, I guess can't both things be true, right?
Yeah.
Which is, look, Kamala Harris's problem, she had a problem that any candidate, male or female, would have, which is she didn't know whether she was going to run as a progressive or run as a moderate. And she was struggling. She was trying to run in both lanes, right? That's why her, you know, what was the moment that really undid Kamala Harris's campaign? The fact that, are you for Medicare for All or not, right?
Yeah.
And there would be times that she were, times that she weren't, and you just couldn't get a straight answer out of her, right? She was trying to not alienate either wing, and she just, progressive didn't view her as a true progressive, and moderates didn't think she was a real moderate, right? So in that sense, you know, to me, that was her problem. She already had the other two hurdles in her way, right? So I don't want to sit here and say those two issues weren't real. They are. But she also didn't know who she was as a candidate. Elizabeth Warren, on the other hand, knows exactly who she is. I think Elizabeth Warren's problem as a candidate was she came across as inaccessible. And I say it this way. Everything you describe her as is what I think, man, this is a huge brain. I enjoy conversations with her. It is really hard to get to her. As a reporter, it is really hard. And I say this, you know, she's very, when she wants to come on, she comes on, right? But I think that translated in her campaign.
Huh.
It very much felt like she was a podium candidate and she was a lecturer. And rather than in the middle of it all. That said, I know the selfie thing was a thing that took off and she did that. But I think she had an accessibility issue or the perception of an accessibility issue, you know, and I don't, and again, is some of it wrapped in sexism? Perhaps. I don't want to eliminate that, but I also think she was also, you know, she didn't have a natural constituency with African-American voters. It's just not something she's had to work on over the years, including in Massachusetts. And I think that also set her back, right? Joe Biden had a long relationship in the African-American community that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders didn't have. And that's been a problem for all these progressive leaders so far, is they've never been able to bridge that divide.
You know, at the end of the conclusion of the last campaign, I think Marjorie and I both decided, based on common sense, we thought that being in your young 70s and having not won a primary, it means that's it for you. Until the bar was totally moved in terms of age. She's one of the fittest people we've ever had in the studio, beyond what we're all saying.
I do not think of her. She's somebody that if you ask me how old she was, I'd just assume in her early 60s.
No, she's incredible.
So, you know, she says it's Pond's cold cream. I want to.
She did say it to you.
That's what she did
say. But let me continue for a second.
That's her secret, Pond's cold cream?
That's right.
You know, the adjectives you use to describe her in her candidacy for the presidency are very similar, I think, to the adjectives that we would have used about another person with a big brain who was horrible in his first campaign for governor, Charlie Baker, and he came back as having learned a million lessons about how to connect with people, mm-hmm. and it was a totally different Baker the second time around. Can you see another go for her? And then, well, of course, Biden's going to run, I guess. We'll see. But can you see another go for her post-Biden, or is that too far down the line?
I think it's tough by 2028, you know, I think it's tough. That's where I think this age thing is going to become an issue again for everybody. I think there's going to be an exhaustion
from older candidates
for president, and it may punish her fairly or unfairly. Right. I think that we're going to overcorrect, right? We've had these basically two of the oldest presidents we've had in American history back to back in Trump and Biden. One of the things that you can count on America doing is overcorrecting on these things. If you told me in the next 10 years we elect two of our youngest presidents, in the last 50 years, it wouldn't shock me.
Well, it's sort of the Obama to Trump kind of thing, too, not just age,
you know,
but in terms of politics. Yeah, but I'm sorry, Marjorie.
One other thing I was just going to say about the Kamala Harris-Elizabeth Warren dilemma is there are exceptions. Laura Ingraham, who's a big star on Fox, would be an exception. I don't think she's a particularly likable person. But generally, in politics...
She's likable enough.
Yeah, exactly. Women have to be likable. They certainly have to be likable on television for the most part, or on radio.
Well, I think men do too now.
You think so?
The unlikable. Well, I think the unlikable character for television is becoming less attractive.
Yeah.
I do. Like, if you know, I think that Tucker Carlson is an exception. You know, the unlikable. He is sort of one of the unlikable. But even like a Sean Hannity tries really hard to come across as likable.
But
right?
But like Donald Trump is not likable. Ron DeSantis is not likable.
And
Joe Biden is likable. So I don't know. Maybe it isn't so sex divided as it used to be. But maybe you're right, Chuck. I don't know. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah, can we move on to something else that Marjorie and I fight about all the time that you sort of indirectly weighed in on? You're doing some interview with some local news people, maybe in Wisconsin, I don't know, because Aaron Rodgers came up too. But you were talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court race with $30 million already being spent. For those who don't know, there's a race for Chief Justice. It's an elected position. It will swing the 5-4 balance, or whatever the majority is. I'm not sure if there's 7 or 9 justices on issues like gerrymandering, abortion, et cetera, in a state that's becoming more red. Marjorie and I fight about electing judges. For example, we are one of the few jurisdictions here where we don't elect judges. Marjorie thinks it's wonderful that we don't. I think if you believe in democracy,
look at
you vote.
State Supreme Judicial Court.
Okay, fine. Were you on this election issue, Chuck Todd?
I think it's crazy to elect judges. Sorry.
Thank you.
Jim.
Thank you, Chuck.
I can live with
you, Marjorie.
A brilliant observation.
Here's the thing. If you look, obviously, we now our U.S. Supreme Court, that none of them wear black robes, right? We know which ones wear red robes and which ones wear blue robes. It's not great. And in many ways, the Senate has really screwed this up. I would argue that the Supreme Court, our problem in the judiciary is that the Senate became polarized, right? Like, in a polarized Senate creates a polarized judiciary. But in theory, the idea of, you know, to me, I'd have a judiciary like, you know, when they got rid of the filibuster, to me, it was like the exact opposite of what I would have done. What do you do when you have a teenager that acts up? Do you lessen the punishment? Do you make require? Let's say your teenager didn't take out the garbage. You tell them, all right, well, this week for your allowance, I just want you to pull the garbage out of the can. You don't have to take it out. Like, you wouldn't ask him to do less with a bill. Like, I think it should take 75 votes to confirm a Supreme Court justice, right? You force, if imagine what type of justices get nominated if it took 75 votes to get a confirmation. You had to get 3/4 of the Senate. And what would you get? You'd get some pretty neutral, milquetoast, middle-of-the-road justices. But I think everybody would be comforted that it would be somewhat fair-minded, right? It's just like you would have a whole bunch of moderates who would worry about the on the one hand, the other hand. When you put this to an election, you watch this. I watched this Wisconsin debate this week, okay? It was not a debate on judicial philosophy. It might as well have been some crappy congressional debate. You lie. You want to get rid of crime. You want to get rid of abortion. You're like, you know, I want to know how you're interpreting laws that the state of Wisconsin is going to pass. You guys are not a legislature. I don't give it, you know. And yet it's turned into this. And they're supposed, how are you supposed to take a donation on Monday, an election on Tuesday, and be a fair-minded individual on Wednesday to that donor who has something before your court?
Exactly.
Okay, let me end with this. Sorry I asked. Good to see you, Chuck Todd.
Chuck, thank you.
Wow. Is that what happens, Marjorie?
Like, yeah, that's exactly
is what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Over.
And Chuck, I'm loving the Toddcast. Congratulations on it.
Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome.
And I'm on more than... I do it three. Actually, we do 3 episodes a week.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. What days? What days?
No, Sundays after the show, Wednesdays and Fridays.
Great.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's
we'll
great.
Make the correction.
Check it out. Anyway,
all right.
Thank you very much.
And you know what?
What?
You guys are going to be at the library tomorrow, so don't miss it.
Thank you. Thanks for reminding us.
Speaking with NBC See you later, political bye. Director Chuck Todd, moderator of Meet the Press, co-host of Meet the Press Now and NBC News Now. Oops, NBC NBC Now, and host of the Chuck Toddcast, which has three airings a week. You can catch Meet the Press Sunday mornings 10:30 NBC Boston Channel 10 on most providers. Okay, coming up, the future of public beach access is getting called into question at Andrews Point in Rockport. GBH News' Chris Burrell is reporting on beaches a lot. We're asking you, are Massachusetts beaches falling victim to greedy waterfront homeowners? 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the library tomorrow. I think Chuck Todd just mentioned that.
He did just mention it. Yes, he did.
Tomorrow, the Attorney General joins us 1 to 2. Originally, it said 11 to 12. She had a change for reasons that we'll let you know about. Tomorrow, 1 to 2, she'll be with us live at the library. Please join us as well. During the cruelest days of COVID, this lawyer, Elizabeth Fisher, peered out of her house's waterfront window. This is Rockport. She notices that people were, once again, making use of the public path by the water in front of her house, strolling by the rocks, taking the sea air. It was then that she knew she had to do something. That's according to Billy Baker in the Boston Globe. And do something she did. She filed two lawsuits, one against town, the other against state, trying to keep members of the public from being able to walk the strip of land that crosses her property by the water. We've been here for decades, by the way. GBH's Chris Burrell, he's been on the show about it, has done brilliant reporting about diminishing public beach access as wealthy homeowners plant their no trespassing signs, as this woman did, in the sand. Something like, get this, only 12% of our state's shoreline. This is in a report that was done 30 years ago. 12% of our state's shoreline at that time was open to the public, and it's surely not getting any better. So the phone and text lines are open at 877-301-8970. Have you seen this kind of thing in your community? Do homeowners have a right to peace and quiet in the space that their houses look out over? Or do you fall in line with one Rockport resident who called Fisher's pursuit of exclusivity, Jim, landscape terrorism? As the weather improves, beaches are on our minds. Is it time to just make them accessible to everybody? Free the beaches. Enough with the restrictions. Or, as your view is, you own the property. You own the property. We'll explain to you what the law is in a second. The number is 877-301-8970. Do you know who was an odd champion, a populist champion of sort of, I don't know if he would have called it this, freeing the beaches to the average member of the public?
Billy Bulger.
Bill Bulger, when he was president
of
the Senate.
The Senate president, very powerful.
The big thing about this.
Which tells you something about how difficult it is to change the laws, because usually what Billy
That's
Bulger
a great point.
Wanted, Billy Bulger, Bill Bulger got, but not in this case. You know, it also brings into question in this story a lot of what the towns do. I think Chris Burrell's story pointed out how the town of Marshfield got a state grant, Commonwealth of Massachusetts grant, for $2 million to build a seawall by their Sunrise Beach because they get a lot of storms there.
Yeah.
But towns limit people outside the town from coming to their towns to go to the beach with, you know, you can't get beach stickers and all that kind of thing. I was thinking before when Chris Burrell mentioned his stories about how these parking lots at these town beaches fill up like at 9 o'clock in the morning. Stacey Thompson would tell you, you just ride your bike to the beach and then you can you can get in. But if you have to lug a lot of stuff like beach chairs and coolers, you're not going to be able to do that on your bicycle.
But
it is a huge problem.
But don't leave this issue. We discussed exactly what you're talking about with Chris Burrell when he was on the show and said, why aren't some legislators saying, if we're going to pour millions of dollars into your individual town's beaches, why isn't the condition for you getting the state money that the state's people who happen not to live in your one little town have at least some access to your beaches? By the way, let me explain what the law is without giving you a real headache, and then we'll move past it so we don't have to dwell on this thing. There's this... There are only three states plus us, ocean-facing states in the U.S., according to Chris Burrell, that allow private ownership all the way to the low tide line. And that essentially gives them total control of this. And the intertidal zone, which is a strip of sand between the low and high tide lines, under state law can only be used for fishing, fowling, I assume that means looking at birds or something, and navigation. We don't know what navigation means. There's a bill in the legislature from Dylan Fernandez, who's a state rep from the Cape, and Julian Sear, who's the senator, which would add a single and pretty radical word to the list, according to Chris Burrell, recreation. I mean,
right.
You can do whatever you want. And by the way, in fairness to this woman, who, as Marjorie noted this morning, when Craig Walker took her picture for the Globe.
She's daring.
Well, I'll tell you, she has a lot of courage to whatever. That is a tough photo. You can look at it yourself.
Describe it. She's standing on the railing of her house. She looks very serious and pretty scary. If she told me to get off her property, I would mean
I get off.
Exactly. 2 seconds.
But she is saying, according to her lawyers, that she's willing to work out a compromise.
Yep.
A lot of people in the town don't want there to be compromise. She says, you know, they're doing dangerous things like jumping from the rocks. Others say, all we want to be able to do is picnic and walk through. So there is this, but we don't want to get lost in the Rockport thing. Even though if you want to talk about it, it's fine. We want to talk about the inaccessibility of beach access in the state as a whole.
I'm with her on one thing.
What is it?
If I live like 50 feet from the water and people were playing music from 8 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, I would have a little trouble
with people
that.
Playing music 8 in the morning to 9 o'clock at night?
That's what they're not saying, from 8 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock at night, but that's one of her complaints. People are playing music, and they might be peering into her bathroom with their big binoculars.
I don't see any evidence any of that, by the way. That's her allegation in her litigation.
I'm just saying if there's a music problem, because if she's playing music you don't like, remember the guy?
Yeah, but you keep
saying
something
we don't
know.
What was the story about the guy that was driving up by all the fancy homes, blasting like Sopranos.
Was the Sopranos. When a real estate guy or something didn't give Tony's wife whatever license she needed, he docked his yacht right off the guy's property and was playing, I think, opera or something. Ear-shattering
torturing
levels.
The people with the noise. Okay. I get the noise angle, but the thing is, the towns have got to get involved in this too, because they're asking for money from everybody in Massachusetts while keeping everybody from Massachusetts outside their town off their beaches.
By the way, are you amazed, before we start this, you amazed that there's not more discussion of this every spring and summer? Because I'll tell you, I love beaches. I'm not like, I don't go every single day. I don't like lying on the beach forever in the sun, but I love beaches. I love the water.
Yeah.
I love the ocean. I'm aggravated every single year I've lived here you have to get up. If you want to go to, for example, the beaches in on the North Shore, Ipswich, or one of those beautiful, what's the name of the incredibly beautiful beach on the, in
the National
Ipswich.
Seashore you're talking
no,
about?
No, this is
in Ipswich.
Yeah. On the
I don't know.
Trusty of Reservations, whatever it's called.
Oh, Crane Beach?
Crane, and there's also another one.
Beach is in Gloucester.
Wingershake, right. That's
beach.
That's
in Gloucester.
Okay, but my point was, you got to get in line at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And I know they're changing the ticketing thing in some fashion. So, and I also understand that private property owners may be entitled to some compensation if the beaches were freed. But the current situation is just not accessible, acceptable.
I have a kid that goes up to one of those North Shore beaches a lot. And she says, you know, you can pay somebody $50 a day and park in their driveway.
Yeah.
So the homeowners might like up there in those towns.
Like in Brookline, the people, the city
council. Cash.
Isn't that what happens in Brookline with the selectmen, according to you?
Paved over their backyards because they're going to charge everybody $100-$200 a month.
Marjorie's
going to
get sued. Let's go to backyards. Look who the first caller is from Rockport.
From the
hey, Jim.
Scene of the crime.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Hi, Jim.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hello there.
Hi.
People have been making walks every Sunday on the specific Rockport Trail that's been there for 150 years. The Atlantic Path, it's called.
Yep.
And they gather every Sunday so they can record use. Now, this is ridiculous. They've been going back with this for 100 years or more. But people want access because there lives less. So they start maybe a little more use of the Atlantic Path than there used to be. But these are mostly homes that the residents are there a month, 2 months out
right.
of the year.
Yeah.
And it's right near the water. It's right on the edge. So it absolutely does not hinder or go into their property. One lady, or I don't know if it's a lady, one person, their homeowner, put up all kinds of crap to block people. Just ridiculous. I'll let it go at that.
But by the way, Jim, you raised a really important point. We're going to get into the case, but according to Billy Baker's writing, by the time this woman bought the property, there had been public access to this space since what was it, the late 1800s
it was
or something?
In the deed.
So she bought
it. The deed from 1887.
Yeah.
So she wants to change that, obviously.
So you made some great points, Jim. You sound like a Rockportian, if that's the right word. I love that. Jim, good luck to you. I hope you continue to have those walks along those rocks there. It looks beautiful. Thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. You haven't taken a position here. Where are you?
I have somewhat a different view of this because where I grew up, there were a lot of public beaches.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about today. How about today?
And I have absolutely no problem with people walking up and down the beach and people sitting on the beach if they're not being obnoxious. I do have a problem with some people blasting music.
Okay, fine. Forget that you keep saying blasting. Let's assume I just want to sit down and have a picnic with my family on the beach between your house and the ocean. Is that okay? Because, by the way, it's not okay by law. That's recreation.
Well, I'm thinking of the beach I know best, which is Craigville Beach that's near Hyannis. You can't walk down in front of a homeowner's house and have a picnic. But I'm thinking to myself, why wouldn't you just have a picnic on Craigville Beach? It's a huge, big beach, and there's a snack bar there and bathrooms there. I mean, I don't, like, maybe you want to buy yourself,
I guess. 88% of the coastline, according to the state's report from 30 years ago, is not accessible to the public. That's okay with you?
No, that's not okay with
me. Well, that's what you're saying. That's what it sounded to be saying. Because
well, I guess
you all go to Craigville Beach or something?
Or Horseneck Beach, another big beach that's next to the
God.
Town beach.
There's a principle here.
Well, I'm also not sure about towns. If you live in a town, should you get preferential treatment going to your town beach, which is maintained by your town? Or should everybody in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts be able to go to your town
beach? Well, they should at least have some access. Would you agree?
It's a tough one because you are paying a lot more for houses in those places. Mm-hmm. You're paying a lot
more in your taxes to maintain the beach. What if the state has spent money to deal with erosion or something else?
That's a different story.
Okay,
that's absolutely a different story.
Marjorie's being very squirmy in this conversation.
Because most places I know, I don't know the Outer Cape that well, but most places I know have big town beaches, and then they have public beaches. Mm. And then they have people's property down the way.
Marjorie is siding with the landed aristocracy. It's pretty obvious. We all know it.
That's
right. We all hear it.
Well, I do have a big manse on the ocean. I didn't want to reveal that, but, you know.
Chelsea in New Hampshire, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi. So I grew up on Eastern Long Island, and this has been a big issue out there, too, for years. And in the 70s, it was up to the high water mark. So if the water came up to that point, it was public land. You could walk on the beach, walk your dog.
Yep.
No problem. You were kayaking. You got tired. You could take a break. Every new resident who moves in tries to erect a fence. They try to put up signs. They try to put a lawsuit in. And it's like clockwork every year. And then the town goes in. They take the fences down. They take the signs down. But here we are. It's the biggest exercise in futility.
Yeah.
And it's funny because my dad fishes the Cape, and so he has a group of friends that they go up to the Cape in the fall, spring they go down to Long Island, and it's the same deal. They can't fish. People come out and yell at them.
I hate this.
Try to chase them off.
I hate it. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than access to the ocean. It's really, I mean, and I guess it's not a basic right, but to me it should be a basic
right. Yeah, you
should
be able to fish, and you should be able to walk, and you should be able to sit down. I just don't want anybody to blast music.
Well, Corey, will you stop with the music? I'm sorry, Chelsea. What?
Or if you're tired, you're kayaking.
Exactly.
You're like, oh, wow, it's hot out. I need to take a break, and you're going to get charged with trespassing because you picked the wrong plot of land.
Chelsea, one of the stories that Chris Burrell highlighted when we spoke with him about this a year or two ago was some poor guy was an elderly guy. And he was out either in a kayak or some kind of raft
or something.
The guy's tired. I think he's going to have a heart attack or a stroke, and he pulls up on shore to rest, and the guy comes running out
of the house, telling
him he can't stay there. And the guy's, you know, beside himself, gasping for breath or whatever. I'm exaggerating a little bit.
It's fine.
But he was in physical extremis, and the homeowner said, too bad.
No, actually, but you left out part of Chelsea, that was a great call. Thank you. You left out the most important part of the story,
that?
As always. In his kayak, he had a boombox, and he was blasting.
All bets are off. You know, ditch the boombox.
Chelsea, thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. I mean, isn't it, you know what this is one of, don't you think that if you're not one of the homeowners who's lucky enough to have access to the beach, that almost everybody, which is the vast majority of people, believe we should at least have some access,
we should have access
to all these beaches kind of thing?
We should have access.
And by the way,
absolutely.
And the issue, I'm totally for this Fernandez and Sear bill, just that recreation to the list of what you can do between the low and high tide lines. The problem is there will be lawsuits because the property owners are going to say you're taking their property without compensation. And my response to that, if that's a legally sound position, then the state should create a fund to pay them something for their beach access, a limited
amount of
money. Of
course, in a few more years, we're not going to have these discussions. You know why? There won't be any houses on the waterfront. And that will solve the whole problem. Christine from Connecticut, thank you for calling.
Hello, Christine.
Hi.
Hi.
Long time, first time.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yes.
Thanks.
Oh, good. So I am married to a Rockport native.
Oh, great.
We do not live in Rockport.
Mm-hmm.
And his family is multi-generational. And I'll tell you, these people need to walk on the beach. They should be able to walk on the beach. They always did. And I think they should be able to continue to.
Totally.
The gentleman from Rockport earlier was talking about the Atlantic Path group, and I see their posts on Facebook. And, you know, I think they're pretty respectful and considerate. And I think that if people are respectful and considerate, let's just let them be. It's human nature to be kind. People should not be fearful. They should be treated with kindness and respect.
Well, you're a good
person.
Thank you, Christine,
listening.
Don't go away for a second. Did your husband tell you stories when he was walking that path in Rockport of people playing loud music from 6 a.m.
No.
to midnight?
So he like went to college. We got married. We've never lived in Rockport.
Rockport is a beautiful place.
Christine, thanks for the call. We're glad to hear from you.
It was a great call. And this story by Billy Baker does point out that there have been families, including the Bryant family apparently, that's picnicked on this Andrews Point for more than 50 years every Wednesday night of the summer. And you would hate to have those people be disallowed from their picnicking again, as long as they don't blast.
Okay.
Have you noticed, if you ever go out,
I did
spend my summers on a lake on the Cape.
I know you did.
And I'm very lucky. I thank my father every time we come over the Sagamore Bridge.
Yep.
But I've noticed now, everybody's got their boat, even these little boats,
rowboats.
I do. Yeah. I have a nice little 1985 Boston Whaler. It's the treasure of my life.
I know.
Anyway, they got these stereo systems on their boat, so you're out there for a little peace and quiet. And
are you listening to yourself?
Yeah, you've got one person blasting some horrible music on one side, one person blasting.
Yeah.
Can't they be without their music for 15 minutes, you know, out in the middle of the lake?
Okay.
I'm upset about it, as you can
You know,
tell.
I wasn't going to say this, but I spoke to Billy Baker this morning.
Uh-huh.
He's the guy who wrote the Globe, so there's a follow-up piece in the Globe tomorrow. There's a band that has actually situated itself on the rocks outside this woman, Elizabeth Fisher's, is that her name, house? And they are playing. You know what they're doing? 24/7.
That's
they are
right.
playing.
But you know what? And music really carries across the water.
It does.
But you know what?
No.
In just a few years, we're not going to have to worry about that either.
No, we're not.
It's going to be so polluted they won't be able to put the boats
exactly.
in it. Dave from Falmouth, thank
good.
You for calling.
No, Marjorie's making good points here. Go ahead,
thank
Dave.
You.
You're welcome.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hey.
First time caller. Long time listener. Thank you for the subject.
Thank you.
I live in Falmouth on the corner of the Cape. Lived here most of my life. And if you know this area, we have about less than a quarter of our coastline is actually public. And it's a pain in the ass to access. Oh, excuse my language. And I'm also involved in a sailing program here. I run a youth sailing program. And access to sailing is really important to me. We're a nonprofit open program, which is great. In the past, not so much, but we've changed.
What's it called? What's it called, Dave?
It's called Wild Harbor Sailing. It's in North Falmouth.
Great, that's great. Keep going.
We have about 150 kids.
Fabulous.
Both introduction and racing program. So yeah, I just think it's a really interesting issue, and I appreciate you guys bringing it up. And
Dave, repeat what you said about the percentage of the Falmouth beaches that are open to the public. I missed that.
Yeah, I'd say it's less than a quarter.
Less than a quarter. Yeah, that's not very much.
All overcrowded, and I've gotten yelled at multiple times. The only time that you can really access the private beaches again is at low tide in the winter when you're not going to get yelled at.
Hey, Dave, that was a great one, too. And congratulations on the program. That sounds terrific. We really appreciate it. Before we take a break, Marjorie, Liz, priced out of Cambridge, has written, I think, a really moving
communication to us. If we're just making up theoretical complaints like Marjorie's 8 a.m., actually it's 6 a.m., to 9 p.m. music, I'd like to note that I also wouldn't like to have people having old-time gun duels on my property, open-air sperm banking, or any other nonsensical activity outside my window. So she wants to add to your list of
I think Liz makes a lot of
hypothetical.
Great points. I'm not sure what open-air sperm banking is.
Let me tell you, whatever it is, I do not want it anywhere near my property. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, next caller is going to be a Rockport caller, too, in a minute.
Oh, good.
We'll be right back.
We are talking about public beach access in Rockport and all around the Commonwealth. What's clear is we don't have enough of it. We're going to keep going after the break. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the library tomorrow. The Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, will join us for Ask the AG from 1 to 2. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the state of public beach access in Massachusetts. As we said, Chris Burrell, our colleague here, GBH, did great reporting the last couple of years, citing a 30-year-old report, so we assume it's worse now, where only 12% of beaches were accessible to the public. The story that got us talking today is one by Billy Baker in the Globe, where this one woman in Rockport is litigating access to the public to the Rocks Beach in front of her house on Andrews Point up there in Rockport. And the question is basically, are you okay with this? I don't just mean Rockport, but are you okay with having virtually no beach access, public beach access in the state? If you are, fine. You can tell us why. And if you're not, should we be freeing a lot of these beaches in one legal way or another? What are you about to say?
And we should point out this particular section, Andrews Point, where she lives, this woman lives, as the Globe reports, has been one of the jewels of the Atlantic Path, that two-mile stretch of rocky shoreline, a mecca for birders and fishermen, hikers and picnickers for years.
Right, that first Rockport caller mentioned doing it all the time. Yeah,
Jane in Rockport.
Rockport.
The scene of the crime.
Hey,
thank
Jane.
You for calling.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me, and thank you for covering this.
Sure.
A few points I wanted to make. I'm one of the locals, grew up near there, who played there as a child.
Oh.
I walked it for 60 years since my dad first carried me on it.
Oh, wow.
And I'm also one of the people who walk on Sunday mornings who climb the barriers of the block section, although that's apparently a done deal and we're supposed to walk down along the tide line now.
Mm.
But anyway, that's one thing. And then the Andrews Point issue, the rocks where people have picnicked, as my family have for years, and people fish. A point I wanted to make that in the article in the Boston Globe, it stated that having some thought problems, is that hasn't been mentioned is people who fish there. And I just wanted to say that some non-residents show up to fish in the summer, and you can tell that they're feeding families. They're non-residents, people of color, their cars aren't that fancy, and they have a right to access the shoreline for that. They're feeding their families, and that was what the point I was going to make was in the article about how people are during COVID there was an increase in traffic on the rocks, she said, and that's the point I was trying to make is that a lot of it was people out of town fishing, and I believe because I walk there every night is people feeding their families.
We're not experts in this area, Jane, needless to say, but it appears from the legal definition of what is permissible that fishing is one of the permissible purposes, even on private land between the high and low tide line. So are people stopped from doing that, as far as you know? Or
she wants to. That's her.
Really?
That would,
oh, she does.
She would stop that.
Okay.
Yeah, she would stop that. She doesn't want anyone down there. And she had signs during COVID, do not trespass because of COVID.
Out there in the windy point.
There's weird signs down there.
That's a good one. Jane, that was a great call. Thank you.
Here's a good one. In Italy, where I have a home on the water, lucky person, the law requires a certain amount of public space adjacent to all privately owned beaches. In Mattapoisett, where I grow up, there's a teenager stationed at the beach questioning if you are from the neighborhood.
Oh, my God.
Enough said. Wow.
That's
Mark from Sharon says, if landowners want to keep people away from the ocean, the state federal government should stop bailing them out when the ocean causes destruction. I think we don't do that anymore. You have to have this massive amount of
where was the place where a few years ago that one single house?
Plum Island.
It was a Plum Island. It's been rebuilt with federal funds over and over and over again.
I think that is not happening. They put the kibosh on that. You have to get very expensive hurricane insurance or flood insurance or private insurance. And that's what happened down in Florida. A friend of mine was just down, and my cousin actually, was just down in Fort Myers and said she was brokenhearted to see the destruction down there. A lot of the beaches there are closed because of the nails and the bits of wood and crushed houses that are on the beach, and people there did not have that kind of insurance. They couldn't afford it, and so they're just out of luck. John from Falmouth, thank you for calling.
Hello, this is John.
Hi,
yes.
John. How are you?
Good. How are you doing? So I live in Falmouth, and I'm not a beachfront homeowner. We do enjoy the beaches from many different aspects. We walk our dog on the public, and sometimes even cross over to the private. But my concern is that in my landlocked home, I ask that people respect my property line, and I'm mandated to respect theirs. And what we've done is we've created a special situation with the beach where someone can have a property line in Massachusetts and they ask folks to respect it, but those other folks, the folks who wish to go on their property, should be treated differently than they are in the landlocked house. So I don't think the problem is the people. I think the problem is with the law. We are giving special treatment to a certain type of property, i.e. beachfront property. And so I think that what we, you know, if we're going to say we're going to break down property or land into those who have and have not, you can either have it that way or have it the other way, where we're going to create a high water mark or some barrier that you can't own property.
Well, the alternative, by the way, the legislation, I don't know if you're listening, that State Rep Fernandez and State Senator Sear has filed, says that in that intertidal, if that's the proper terminology, between low and high tide, add to allowable activities of the public, recreation, which means that while they'd still have a right to that land, they wouldn't have a right on their, quote, property to preclude you or me or Marjorie from doing whatever we consider to be fun, as long as we're not doing something horrible or breaking the law. So I think they'd achieve the same goal. And you make a wonderful point about landlocked property and oceanfront property. John, thanks for making it. We really appreciate it. That Paul is a great point, by the way.
That is a great point, which I haven't thought of. So thank you very much for calling. Paul from Worcester.
Here it goes.
Man.
I can tell the look on Marjorie's face is about loud music.
No, it's not.
Okay.
As someone who doesn't live near a beach, I think all beaches should have full access. That said, if I had beachfront property, it would be fortified like Normandy.
Well, I mean, that is part of the problem. Is it not? Isn't it? It is the problem.
That is the problem. And another texter says, I would also pose the question to those trying to, quote, privatize their beaches. Do they hike? Should I close the hiking trail behind my house that leads to a mountain and a gorgeous view? I say unless people are rowdy or cause issues, natural resources should be shared.
You know, and by the way, you say to yourself, as long as people aren't creating a problem, and there was no evidence to me when Billy Baker was listing what this woman's lawyer, she's a lawyer too, her lawyer was listing as her concern. There was no proof, at least in the article, that her allegations are true. If someone's not destroying your quiet enjoyment of your property,
right?
Why would you, even if the law allows you to bar them, why wouldn't you let people enjoy oceanfront sand and rocks?
I don't get it. If people are just sitting there or they're... You know,
They're having fun. They're having a picnic or whatever. Go ahead.
Dave from Marshfield wants to know, should you be allowed to play pickleball between high and low tide marks?
As long as you do it quietly.
That is a good question. And Buster's reminding us it was Tony Soprano. I guess his wife was doing some real estate or
something. I said that, and they were barring her from getting a permit or whatever she needed. Yeah.
And Buster says that Tony's boys were playing Dean Martin songs.
Oh, it might have been. I think it might have been Dean Martin.
So that would be.
Really
would be
loudly great. Is the point.
Really loudly right in front of the house. Oh, but the next texter is saying they blast Sinatra. I don't know.
We'll check it out. Whatever it was, it was loud music that was driving, but it was 24/7 kind of thing.
24/7, that's
right.
Correct.
And it was a boat, a yacht or something that Tony owned from which they were doing it. Rick in Cambridge, you're next. Hi.
Hi. So I believe that people should have full access, walkways, two beaches, up to the high tide mark. Most of the people there are to walk, hike, sit, enjoy their surroundings, fish, and bird. I do think that there should be a state law that prohibits music on the beach.
You are my man. You are my man, Rick. Thank you for calling.
It's debatable.
For everybody that's hiking, sitting there, being with their family, fishing and birding, music just destroys the environment. If they want to listen to music, put in your earbuds.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you, Rick.
I love you. Thank you for calling.
Another ridiculous position like yours. If it's too loud, obviously, but music is...
Jim, how many times have you been to a public beach, now I'm talking, where somebody on one side is blasting music you don't like, somebody on the other side is blasting music you don't like, then you pick up and you move your stuff, you go to the other side of the beach, and the other side of the beach, somebody's doing the same thing.
Okay.
You are invading someone else's space. Mm. That's the problem, right?
Okay.
It's just like when a little kid picks up their towel and shakes it, and you get sand all over you. Mm-hmm. They're invading
exactly
your space.
Exactly like that.
Mine, you know... Be polite, be respectful.
Well, be polite, respectful. Would you ban Eton emergency crank radios from the beaches? You wouldn't, would you?
That is different because we only use the Eton crank radios,
Actually, that's not true. You can use them anytime. You just crank them up and you play the whatever.
Not playing your music. I remember, I'm so old, I remember bringing transistor radios to the beach. I'm sure I annoyed everybody around me.
Okay, Patrick, you have a minute. Car. That's all we have left. Take it away, Patrick, quickly. Hi.
Oh, quickly. Well, I grew up in Kansas, so I'd appreciate having access to a beach. But if I could tell my quick story about the first time I visited the Atlantic Ocean, I was with a friend of mine who had taken me to Freeport to see L.L. Bean. We were coming back, and he said, the ocean's right over there. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, really? So I pulled down one of these side streets and ran towards the ocean. And about that time, porch lights start flipping on. And my friend had explained that this guy's from Kansas. He's never seen the ocean. People started laughing. We're somewhere in Maine. I don't know where. But people were laughing hysterically. They finally invited us for coffee. Somebody made pancakes. We had a great time talking about the ocean. So that was my first experience.
That's a pretty good one, too. Thanks for sharing that story with us, Patrick.
That's a wonderful story. But we're going to end on a more probably common story.
Oh,
apparently, there's a woman in Scituate who throws eggs at people from her house when they use sand in front of it. So there you go. Patrick had a nice story. The texter had a not-so-nice story.
Yeah.
Okay, we are done.
We should revisit this with Chris Burrell for an update. I'm sure
absolutely.
He knows more.
Okay, after a quick break. We're going to get more details on a police officer who was protesting outside Mayor Wu's house. The commissioner now wants to fire this cop. Wait to hear more about her. Plus, the second cop who was in D.C.
Wait a second. She's been fired. You were talking about the one who's been fired.
Well, she's been fired temporarily, at least. She's probably going to get rehired
that's
what they usually do. Anyway. Former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral is going to talk about us about that and more after a quick break. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
GBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR, what matters to you.
I'm Jim Brady, head on Boston Public Radio. The Biden administration has threatened to ban TikTok, citing national security threats. Boston Globe columnist Marcela Garcia goes behind the headlines and the catchy video clips to explain how the app has become an economic lifeline for many creators. She'll also reflect on how the murder of those two South Carolinians in Mexico is part of a much bigger, troubling picture.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Then, so much for imminent. Former President Trump has forecasted his own indictment, but it hasn't happened yet. Will it ever happen? We'll speak with retired federal judge Nancy Gertner about the New York prosecutor's case over hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels that may have violated campaign finance laws. Then NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans offers a spoiler-free look at Succession Season 4 and examines The Daily Show's rotating cast of guest hosts and previews Season 3 of Ted Lasso and more. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Thank you for listening to Boston Public Radio. This is hour number two. Hello, Jim Browdy.
Hey there, Marjorie. We're at the library tomorrow. Attorney General Andrea Campbell joins us from 1 to 2. We hope you join us from 11 to 2. We're joined now on Zoom by Andrea Cabral. Andrea is the former sheriff of Suffolk County, former secretary of public safety in the Commonwealth. Hello there, Andrea.
Hello there, Jim. Hello there, Marjorie.
Hey.
Andrea Cabral, great to talk to you. So I read this story about the Boston police officer who was protesting outside of Mayor Wu's house. She had a bullhorn. She has now been fired by the commissioner. But I was stunned by her antics. You ran a prison. I mean, you were in public safety. Tell us about this police officer. She was a sergeant. And what you think of goings-on?
Well, I was actually surprised by the number of incidents that she was being investigated for by Internal Affairs over at BPD. So this is a sergeant. Her name is Shayna Catone or Catone. I'm not sure which way to pronounce it. And, a veteran, I think, of 15 years.
Yeah.
Department, and she basically made a name for herself during COVID as being, sort of rabidly anti-vaccination and very sort of virulently against Mayor Wu's vaccine mandate. And so, there was a period of time where it would be rare to turn on the news and not see her and a bunch of others protesting in front of Mayor Wu's house. In fact, that was some of that is what spurred this ordinance that was placed that you couldn't protest before a certain hour because, neighbors get caught in the crossfire of that. But in any event, BPD did release the Internal Affairs investigation, the findings anyway of that investigation. It's a 38-page summary, which, that's lengthy in and of itself, but there are just repeated, sometimes more than one incident in a single day, incidents of her, whether she was on duty or off duty, violating BPD regulations, things such as when she's on duty as a patrol supervisor, repeatedly leaving sort of the area that she's assigned to and going to a different district where Mayor Wu is giving a press conference so that she can be there. Ostensibly to express herself and her anti-vax views. In one case, it was made very clear that Mayor Wu's remarks, this was during a roll call, were not to be videotaped, and she videotaped them anyway and had to be told to put her phone away. And I think she still resisted putting her phone away at that point. She was going to at least two pizza places, Penguin Pizza and Pizzeria Regina, without a mask on. They were both pizza places that required their customers to wear masks and demanding to be served and refusing to leave. Boston police had to expend resources to respond when she refused to leave both times. She harassed staff. She was disrespectful to her colleagues, accusing them of all kinds of traitorous behavior for not standing with her on this.
Stop there for a second. About her colleagues, here's a line in the Globe story, in an apparent reference to the person who told department officials she had not assigned a detail to Mayor Wu's house.
A detail
right.
That was supposed to be there.
The documents show Catone asked, quote, who is the rat, and stated rats get bats. When Mayor Wu was with us, I think it was last week, and mentioned that one of the firings a third firing. This guy, Geary, who we hadn't known about, was fired for in part saying rats get bats in a different setting. That's a threat, obviously, as you know, having come from law enforcement. I wasn't. She said a couple of the people who were fired were in that situation. I didn't know Catone was one, but that's a threat. Rats get bats is a threat.
This does not sound like a well person to me, and certainly not someone who should have a gun and be out patrolling on the streets. I mean, this is someone does not sound well. Let's put it that way. I mean, what do you think? You know,
I may have sort of buried the lead to some degree when I started talking about it, because that happened. Her failure to assign a protective detail to the mayor, I think her career should have begun and
for
ended
that alone.
Right there. That was in December of 2021. These incidents go pretty well into 2022. She continues to go to the pizza places and other places like that. But that level of that isn't even a dereliction of duty. That is, you know, she, as I was getting ready to say that a captain questioned her about her failure to send this protective detail. And she challenged that and basically said, I don't think we should be protecting her when she's mandating that we be vaccinated. And there doesn't seem to be much of an apology or a recognition that what she did was actually had someone else not assign the detail might have put the mayor in danger.
You know, so also, Marjorie, your conclusion, if I may, respectfully, she's not well. Tens of millions of people in America have, maybe not cops, obviously, share her perspective and have crossed lines that I would argue are lines that should not be crossed, including going into establishments that ban unvaccinated people.
But should they be a person carrying a gun
well,
on the street?
The commissioner decided they shouldn't be.
So here's the question here. This sounds pretty extreme to me. And this woman is going. This case is going to go to arbitration. Her lawyer has already said that. This cop herself, she calls this a witch hunt, which is, of course, what Donald Trump calls everything. So, I mean, are we going to have a firing that stands here, or is this going to be overruled by arbitration? I mean, that's what happens over and over to fired Boston cops.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that will be on the radar screen of any decent arbitrator. Progressive discipline is a big part of most union contracts. So what they will also be looking at is whether or not she has been disciplined in the past and whether or not, you know, how severe that discipline has been. And, you know, discipline can range from an oral warning to a written warning to administrative leave with pay, administrative leave without pay, and ultimately termination or suspension. So I think that will be part of that. But I think it would be very difficult for an arbitrator to look at the collection. The depth and the breadth of this is what I'm really talking about, and think that this is someone who did not earn a termination. Now, anything is possible in an arbitration, and we've seen people get their jobs back for behavior that we've all agreed is absolutely egregious. So, but I think that there will be a certain level of spotlight on this, and I think there'll be a bunch of different considerations, not the least of which is how repeated and intentional this behavior was.
You know, I want to ask you one more really quick thing, and then I want to move past this. One of the other cops that was fired, we asked Mayor Wu about every single month for months and months, this Abbasiano guy who was at January 6th. And a piece by Danny McDonald in The Globe, I think today, says two things. One, apparently he wasn't fired for being at January 6th. He was fired for the text he sent out afterwards about treason from Pence and that sort of thing, because they mentioned that he drove there with another cop who shared his views, Jose Diaz. And they mentioned they did a lot of similar things that day, and Diaz was not fired. And the argument we don't hear this from people in the city, but others say this Diaz was purely exercising his constitutional rights. He wasn't tweeting. I said texting. I meant tweeting these kinds of things. People like Harvey Silvergreat, I have great respect for, a civil liberties lawyer, said, you know, equal protection under the law. He's entitled to speak, that sort of thing. The thing that they don't address that I'm curious to know your philosophy on, and we'll ask Mayor Wu about it when we see her too, and maybe Andrea Campbell tomorrow when she's with us, is I agree with that as a general proposition. But when you're participating in a rally and you're exercising free speech, is in support of a rally, the goal of which is to overturn the government, the duly elected government of the United States, and you're a law enforcement officer. Is that protected? I mean, the police department obviously determined it was protected activity in terms of Officer Diaz. Do you think it's protected activity?
Well, I think that the struggle here is to draw that line, right? So you've seen the same thing in the DOJ's prosecutions of hundreds of people who went to the insurrection. Mm-hmm. And they definitely made a distinction between and choosing whom to prosecute and, you know, in terms of the punishments of some, who went into the Capitol and who did not, who sort of crossed that line and who did not, who engaged in violent behavior in an effort to get into the Capitol and who did not. Now, I don't have any idea what the evidence is about the behavior of either of these officers beyond what's reported here, which is they were there, they attended, neither entered the Capitol, neither entered the building. But I think that that's the issue, is drawing the line between the exercise of free speech, which is hugely important, and behavior that indicates that has a negative impact or could be seen to have a negative impact on that person's ability to do their job.
Exactly.
In this case,
exactly.
To protect and serve equally.
Right. And most of the people the DOJ chose not to prosecute purely for presence were not cops, as far as I know. The issue for me is this Officer Diaz is a police officer, obviously, is a police officer. And obviously, I'm assuming, I don't want to speak for the commissioner, I'm not, obviously, they concluded that mere participation in this rally, again, the purpose of which was to get Congress and or the vice president to overturn the democratic results of an election, it would seem to me having a cop serving you who doesn't believe in the peaceful transition of power in a democracy, to me, that is at least a questionable activity, but we'll pursue it with people in positions of power. We're talking to Andrea Cabral.
You know, Andrea, our colleagues, Philip Martin and Sandra Betancourt, a bunch of our colleagues have done great reporting about undocumented people being abused by their employers.
Yeah.
This latest one,
this
the story, you just can't believe it, is by this pizza owner who's now been in jail. The judge is keeping him in jail, not letting him out after these gruesome trails of allegations involving undocumented immigrants from North Africa, Central America, Brazil. What's going on with this pizza guy?
Well, lots of people know Stash's Pizza. They have a number of locations, around Massachusetts, and the one in Boston is located in Dorchester. So the owner's name is Stavros. I think it's Papantoniadis.
Whatever.
If I'm pronouncing correctly. Yep. He goes by the name of Steve. He's been around for a very, very long time. And Stash's has been around for a very, very long time. And he was a few years ago, I think it was 2019, perhaps, cited by the federal government for failing to pay adequate wages or withholding adequate wages from his employees, and had to pay over $300,000 to those employees. So he's been on the federal government's radar for a few years now. So what ultimately, I guess they continued the investigation. I'm not sure why it took this long, possibly because the people involved are undocumented and there may have been some fear there. But what has ultimately come out is that along with failing to pay them, he was physically violent with his employees and threatened them regularly. In fact, it was sort of the pattern of conduct is, he actively recruited undocumented people to work for him, it seems, because he knew that they'd be a people that he could control.
Absolutely.
That he could get. One person said they worked, I forget the number of hours, but it's just
119 per week.
Okay, 119 a week. When I read it, I thought to myself, this is as close to slavery as you can get as a business owner. And that's really what I thought he was going for, was to basically have people at his beck and call. He had cameras in his locations where if he saw someone taking a break for a meal or to go to the bathroom, he would have microphones there telling them to get back to work inside these stores. And he put one of his employees in the hospital.
You know, we should add that. He kicked one guy in the groin with such force that the man had to have surgery. And in another attack, he broke an employee's upper and lower teeth.
You know, my God. Beyond the sadism, the cruelty of this guy, and he's being held without bail, which is fine by my standards. I have to say, you remember the great line in the Me Too thing, Quentin Tarantino, the director, "We knew enough to have done more." Is it possible to believe that there are not a ton of people, customers, friends, legitimate employees, who didn't know that he had imprisoned? This guy was 15 years one of these people.
Years.
15 years of 100 plus hours a week, physically abused, verbally abused, obviously being labor trafficked or whatever the appropriate term is. It's not possible that there were not either collaborators or collaborators by their silence. And I hope this investigation gets into more about who knew or who might have known about this guy's incredible cruelty. And may he go to, assuming this is true, may he go to prison for a really long period of time. I'm sure there'll be more details about this case in the coming months. You know, you were in the cannabis industry for quite a while there after your public service. Andrew Curbell, Tori Bedford, our colleague and former producer on the show, wrote a piece on GBH, cannabis regulators putting out a series of fires involving a Russian oligarch and data breach. And the Russian oligarch is this guy who's on the sanction list of the United States, Roman Abramovich, who apparently, despite denials, is a multi-million dollar investor, or at least lender, but investor in Curaleaf, which people, I assume, have heard of. I think it's a locally based marijuana company that is the largest licensed weed company, I think maybe even in the world, maybe the United States. It's huge. It's got 100 and some stores in a couple of dozen states. Could you drill down on this for us? And, I mean, it's a pretty troubling thing. And apparently the Cannabis Control Commission is investigating this relationship that may not be legal. What are the key points here we should be concerned about, Andrea?
Yeah, so Curaleaf is huge. It has, a number of stores nation. It's what we call an MSO, a multi-state operator.
Yeah.
But it's been here since medical. Since we were medical cannabis only, right? Mm-hmm. So it was one of the first to sort of gain a foothold in the Massachusetts cannabis industry. And then when we moved on to adult use, they did as well. But this is a confusing story to some degree. There's a well-known blogger, Grant Smith Ellis, who is well-known in cannabis circles. Mm-hmm. And he must have gotten some information about the fact that the Cannabis Control Commission was investigating Curaleaf mm-hmm. because of these, I think it was something like $400 million financing from Roman Abramovich. He did a simple public records request, and somehow the Cannabis Control Commission sent him
this is unbelievable.
A ton of information that included the names, addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, dates of birth of every cannabis worker in the state, both current and former. And there was more in that data set. There was stuff about people who had been fired from cannabis companies and for alleged violations of the reasons were in there. Now, no state agency does that in response to a Freedom of Information Act request. So there's that. There's the fact that someone released a ton of information to Grant Ellis that he probably should not have had, even under a FOIA. And then there's the investigation itself. And so where these two things merge is that the Cannabis Control Commission, Ellis is blogging about the part of this about the investigation and these internal communications that he's received about the Curaleaf investigation. He gets contacted by the CCC, which asks him to take the story down because there's an issue of safety to Cannabis Commission employees. this is something he apparently took very seriously. He moved to a different location that he referred to as a safe house because he thought that based on what they told him, there was this credible imminent threat unless he took the story down. Clearly, that's not really how the CCC sees it. And an anonymous official said, you know, that there was no credible threat to any of the employees. But that's really where this story intersects. There's someone who, a private citizen who filed a FOIA, who got a ton of information that puts, were it not this particular blogger, because I actually do happen to know Bran Ellis.
So do I. And he calls the show from time to time, by the way.
Yeah. I don't think he's the type that would do anything with all this information.
Nor do I.
But, you know, I didn't get an email, and I probably should have because I'm a former employee.
That's a very good point.
So there are probably a bunch of people who have since left the cannabis industry, don't use that email anymore for their business, who didn't even know about it and are reading about it now. But I think the data breach, which the CCC takes full responsibility for and is acknowledging.
Yeah, but that was a very refreshing change, by the way. You don't always see agencies acknowledge and take full responsibility right away. So good for them.
Yeah, I mean, but the investigation, I guess we'll see more on the investigation. Curaleaf has had various issues over the years with the CCC, with, you know, notifying them of ownership changes and certain other things. So they have a ton of information about Curaleaf. So, I'm sure that we'll hear more about that publicly. We'll have to wait and see whether or not. And I don't think anybody's information is going to be compromised as a result of them releasing it to Grant Ellis. But, you know, I'm sure there are people out there, former and current employees, who are concerned.
Well, you're concerned about that, which I am too. I would also like to know a little bit more about whether or not a Russian oligarch who has been sanctioned by the United States is investing hundreds of millions of dollars into a Massachusetts-based marijuana company. I think that's a fair thing.
Through a shell company, through an LLC.
Well, I think we might want to know a little bit more about that. Hey, it is nice to see.
And by the way, is the speculation just he wanted to make some money, or is there something more nefarious?
I don't know.
Afoot?
I think that's what they're really going to have to look at, because there's absolutely, I can't see how, if this is true, Curaleaf didn't know that he was the source of the funding.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrea Cabral. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye.
We've been speaking with Andrea.
By the way,
Cabral,
before you go away, Andrea, are you still there?
Gone. No.
The beautiful thing is your Zoom is such that every time you speak, there's this radiant silver stuff that's coming out of your head. Are you saying
right.
I'm serious. It's beautiful.
It is, beautiful.
It's the background filter.
It's the
background. Great. I love it. Do it again.
I love the background filters that cover a myriad of sins as we spend time on Zoom.
She speaks
know all
and
about. Thank
silver
you, Andrea.
Comes out of her head. It's amazing.
She's radiant.
See ya. Bye,
We've been speaking with Andrea Cabral, former sheriff of Suffolk County and former Secretary of Public Safety for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. After a quick break, Boston Globe columnist Marcela Garcia isn't ready to give up on TikTok. Whether that's because her dog went viral on TikTok or some other reason,
TikTok
we'll find
too.
Out. We'll find out. Pardon me?
TikTok.
TikTok.
Tic-tac, you said.
I said tic-tac? Oops.
Wherever it is.
TikTok. You know what I'm talking about.
I think I do.
We're listening to Boston Public, or you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the library tomorrow. The Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, joins us from 1 to 2 to take your questions. Where are we here? Oh, I know where we are. Joining us now is Marcela Garcia. You know why I know? Because I'm looking at her,
that's
actually.
Right.
She's the associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Marcela, it's great to see you. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
We're well. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, last time you were here, we talked to you about your wonderful dog who's kind of gone famous on TikTok.
He's a dog influencer.
Yeah. He's a dog influencer. Is it a girl dog or boy dog?
Boy dog.
Boy dog. Okay, he's a dog influencer sitting on the steps of your house and like bounding out into the daycare truck that comes to pick him up and stuff. And we were all thought Santo was simply adorable. But we're wondering if this is coloring your opinion about TikTok. The head of TikTok is testifying down in D.C. today to Congress about proposals to ban TikTok or to sell it to an American company. But you think banning is the wrong solution. So I assume this is just not about Santo, your adorable influencer.
Well, listen, the great thing about being an opinion columnist is that you're supposed to be biased. <You're
supposed laughs> That's right.
An opinion. Having said that, I mean, of course, I just, you know, I was thinking recently about how did I become so into TikTok? And it happened during the pandemic when we were all, you know, stuck at home. And it's when I started to sort of discover what the TikTok was, what the app was all about. And then I started filming my dog and then he went viral. And now he has more than 100,000 followers. And he goes viral often on the exact same video, which is him waiting patiently in our porch, waiting to get picked up by the doggy hike van to go on hike. And so it happens every time. And it actually has given me a sense of how the algorithm works, because I think the app knows that when something has gone viral, it shows it to more people because it has learned that people like to see that content. Anyway, having said that, though, I mean, I think the whole ban TikTok narrative, or it's just gaining a lot of steam, obviously. And today, as you noted, the CEO is testifying before Congress. And as you obviously probably remember, former President Trump tried to ban it.
Sure.
And
yep.
What he did was he tried to prevent new downloads of TikTok from app stores, and that was blocked by two judges, right? And so beyond the fact that, yes, I'm a user of TikTok, my dogs are, you know, viral there, etc., you know, there really is more to the story than just banning TikTok. There are legitimate concerns about data privacy issues, but it's not just TikTok. And so to me, singling out TikTok ignores a big part of the issue, which is all these other social media platforms that are collecting our data on the daily. If you have a phone, a smartphone, if you are on the internet every day for work or just to browse on Amazon, et cetera, your data is being collected by third party apps and sold in this marketplace that is practically unregulated. And this is an issue that has been raised by many experts for a couple of years. And Congress has done nothing about that. And the idea of banning TikTok is based on the fact that China can have access to data that TikTok collects on America's 150 million American users on the platform. Well, if TikTok is banned, if the Chinese government wanted data for Americans, the Chinese government can already buy it in this unregulated global data marketplace. So that's basically where I'm coming from. Again, you know, it also seems to be politically motivated, because this anti-China posture is very, very popular, obviously, with certain constituencies. And it also strikes me, too, I'm obviously not a young person, but I'm a user of TikTok. And by and large, the majority of users, American users on TikTok, are, you know, skew young and are on the younger side.
80% are 16 to 34. I looked it up the other day, but go ahead.
There you go. I'm definitely on the 20%. but for them, it just feels to me that the government has not made a strong case as to why it is dangerous to just be on TikTok.
Yeah, and but I want to get back to what you said a minute ago. You say, I'm not sure if your position is that the concerns is that the genie's out of the bottle everywhere, and so we should accept that, or if you're saying unless you're going to address all of the potential privacy violations, not just of a Chinese-owned company, you shouldn't be singling them out. What are you saying?
It's the latter.
Okay.
It's not the former.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying that TikTok is every social media platform should be regulated.
Okay.
It's just that we're not, for some reason, we're singling out TikTok right now. And like I wrote in my column, you know, whatever happened to regulating Instagram, Facebook,
yeah.
in in a more stricter way. And so all of a sudden we're focusing on TikTok, and it just seems to be just kind of like the wrong solution to a very real problem. And that I definitely want to acknowledge that is a real issue, but we should be talking about all the platforms, not just TikTok.
You know, let's follow up with the column you wrote. And this was a fascinating column about the teen mental health crisis. We've been talking a lot about this. Teenage girls particularly are having a struggle. And you focused in on something called Breathe. Tell us about Breathe and what this young woman at Brookline High School is doing.
So as you probably remember, there was a CDC report that was very, very eye-opening because it showed with real data how much American teenagers are struggling, particularly women. And it was at the time I wrote a column about that. And this young woman from Brookline emailed me after I wrote that column and said, hey, I just wanted to put this in on your radar. I started this platform X, Y, and Z. And I thought it was so cool to highlight that in a column, her efforts, because here is a teenager basically creating a platform. Breathe is a website that she launched. She told me that she has a background. She studied coding. And so she did the all the back end, the website, et cetera. And so it's a platform where teenagers can anonymously post there. Think of it as a journal or a diary. Writing in a diary has always been cathartic, right? And she told me I have always found writing cathartic. And so she was struggling with anxiety last year. And she started keeping it was a Google Doc. She said, I opened a Google Doc and I just started pouring my feelings out there. And I found it to be helpful. And I thought, what if I could do this for other people? She launched and created this website called Breathe. And it's just posts, anonymous posts of teenagers with the things that they're struggling with. And she obviously feels that, I mean, it's obviously not a major, major initiative, but like just the act of creating a space for people or for kids, you know, to go and just, you know, give their thoughts or just unload their feelings of sadness. I thought that was pretty remarkable. And she just started it. And, you know, she just said, I also found it interesting that she finds this, you know, sense of gratification too from doing this and from the sense that she's helping other people. I talked to her about social media, by the way, and to another expert, and you know, definitely social media has played a role. There has been studies, right, that Instagram and even TikTok too has played a role in you know, especially women, you know, self-image, all of this, feelings of depression, bullying. But it's not the only thing. It definitely isn't the only component that is causing or that is driving this sense of despair and depression among teenagers right now. It's just one piece of the puzzle. And so she's doing it online. She's doing it on the internet. She's using technology too, to try to do her part to fight this, what I think should be an epidemic of teenage, death, you know, sadness.
Yeah. You know, by the way, can I just read, you start your column with three posts on this Breathe site. I mean, it's so heartbreaking. I was told I'd never be good enough, that my death would bring everyone happiness. Another one, you put yourself in that position, is the sentence that came out of my parents' mouth when I told them I had been raped for the past 2 years. And the third one, I've never really said this before, I was sexually assaulted. I mean, it's not unbelievable. It's unbelievably horrifying is what it is. And this young woman, she's 16 or something
she's
at the
16
time,
years old.
Providing
and she's
an
very
incredible
careful.
Forum.
You know, on the website, she said, you know, she has the, if you're in need of immediate assistance, you know, she gives you the where to go for global emergency services or American hotlines. And the idea is to help these people move beyond trauma. And she's very careful about editing it from what she told you.
Correct.
In this piece.
Correct.
Making sure that, you know, that because I think that's one of the problems for when you go on a lot of sites, you get the good stuff, and then you get the horrible comments, you get the good stuff, and then you get the nastiness, you know.
Right.
I mean, you write a column. When I wrote a column, I didn't used to read, even when I wrote for the Catholic website, I thought, well, I'll get away from the nasty comments here. There's a Catholic website. No, I was wrong. They were just as nasty. So I never read them, but it can, if you read them, it can be really upsetting. And I'm a grown-up. I'm much older than you.
Right. It definitely takes time to build a thick skin regarding the comments on columns. But for her, it was a way to also build safeguards around the content that she's putting out there, because obviously she is, you know, to some extent responsible. And so she filters certain words, she filters certain, because the other thing is that she told me if there are some allegations there that are very specific, I am required to report them as a mandated reporter, right? And so she definitely has done all her homework around the legalities and just providing basically, like James said, a safe space forum for people to unload. Because ultimately, I mean, there obviously are many, many solutions around this. One expert that I talked to said we should just be funding mental health supports for all teenagers.
Absolutely.
We should just, like, no questions asked. I don't care if you need it. There's a person here to help you. But this is, you know, this is just one way of offering some American teenagers some support and just some space to just unload all these things. Like James says, it really is heartbreaking to go through them. I read through most of them, and it's just, you get a sense of how much they're struggling with it. It is striking and just horrifying.
You know, by the way, a couple of people have been in touch with us during this discussion, asking what the name of the former Facebook employee was who leaked those internal documents where there was research at Facebook showing that teenagers felt worse about themselves after. It's Frances Haugen, is that the whistleblower, for lack of a better expression, Haugen. You wrote a really interesting and troubling piece, Marcela Garcia from The Globe, after the death, the murders of two of those four South Carolinians who had traveled to Mexico, right across the border. One of them is there for some tummy tuck or some cosmetic surgery. You know, two survived, two were murdered. And you write, anti-blackness isn't a new dynamic in Mexico, basically making the point this fits into a far larger, troubling pattern that isn't new. What is that pattern? What's going on?
Yeah, it is new for sure. I've written about this before. It's what was interesting when this happened, I remember hearing in the news there were four Americans kidnapped. And I immediately thought in Mexico, I immediately thought this is odd, you know, because I grew up in Mexico. I know I have family in Mexico. And right now there are places in Mexico where it's very, very violent. By and large, though, cartels, this is cartel driven violence, but by and large, cartels just stick to the business of drug trafficking. And so they are violent amongst, you know, within mm-hmm. that realm. They don't go after civilians, et cetera, et cetera. So then I learned that they were black. And so I was just thinking right now, this is in a border town, right? On the Mexican side of a border town, they had just crossed the border. And yeah, allegedly they were going to they were there to do a medical procedure on one of them. And so I know, and I have followed this story, and I've written about the Haitian migrants that have gone through, that have traveled all throughout Mexico to reach the border and to try to make it here. And so I have been reading about anti-Haitian sentiment among the border and beyond. In Mexico, if you're a black person, you know, you're immediately cataloged as a migrant, someone who's not supposed to be there, et cetera. And so then I read that one of the theories that Mexican authorities were offering or just considering is that these four people from South Carolina were confused by Haitian smugglers or Haitian migrants. And that made a lot of sense to me because that's who the cartels may target, you know, to ask for a bribe or to try to somehow traffic with them. In Mexico, there's also this narrative that took hold that they were not there to do this procedure, that they were actually trafficking or smuggling. And so because it's just so rare that American, black American citizens would be targeted, it had to be a case of mistaken identity. And so I just thought that was a good opportunity to highlight and to talk about the anti-blackness, especially against Haitian migrants right now in Mexico, not just Haitian, you know, African too. In the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala, there's a lot of Haitian migrants who have been treated horribly, who have been detained. others coming from Cameroon, other African nations, they all want to make it here. They all want to make it to the United States to seek asylum. They have to go to Mexico, and that is a nightmare because of the anti-Blackness sentiment. And so it's very easy to recognize someone who is Haitian or Black, and so they do get targeted. And so this was a horrible tragedy that happened, but again, it gave me an opportunity, I think, for me to highlight this phenomenon, which not a lot of people are aware of.
Speaking of people who actually are Haitian, you wrote a really important column, I thought, about the humanitarian parole program that isn't only available purely to Haitians, but Haitians are amongst us, Cubans, Venezuelans, I think, and a couple other nationalities. I think the ceiling is somewhere in the neighborhood, you say, $30,000 a month, etc. And there are a number of criteria that need to be met for you to qualify for this humanitarian parole program, the most difficult of which apparently is finding a financial sponsor, which is leading to lots of pain and fraud and horrible things. Fill in that blank for us, if you can.
Well, when this humanitarian parole program was announced, it was open to four nationalities, Cuba, Nicaragua, Haitians, and Venezuelans, $30,000 a month. And I remember when this news came out, it was in the beginning of the year that Biden administration announced it. I thought it was great. Obviously, the greater Boston area is home to a large Haitian diaspora, right? The third largest in the country. And one common sentiment that I heard among advocates and activists was like, this is great. There is a Haitian diaspora here. They are going to be able to sponsor people to come because to be able to use this humanitarian parole program, A, you have to be in your home country. You have to apply from there. And two, you have to have a financial sponsor. And that means, I mean, some people wrongly assume that you have to put money up front or that you have to pay for these persons, you know, everything. And it's not true. You just basically have to show that you are financially stable enough to, you know, maybe help this person if they need it. That's it. I mean, it's very common in the immigration world, by the way. There are certain visas that require this type of financial support. We did it also with Ukrainians last year when the war broke out. So it isn't a foreign concept. But then what I wrote about is that Haitian advocates started calling me to say that we don't have sponsors. And what we have is a lot of people desperate to leave Haiti in desperate need of a sponsor. And so I wanted to show what it entails and that it really doesn't mean anything more than filing a form, sending perhaps, you know, your taxes, and sending a letter of employment, showing how much money you make, et cetera. And then the person that you're sponsoring gets a permit, it gets an approval to travel here. And that's it. That is it. Then they come here, they can get a work permit. They apply for a work permit and they can work and they can essentially be on their own. But then there was all this other noise. There was some misinformation around some Haitians saying, be very careful about who you, some pastors, I'm saying be very careful about who you sponsor. These people could be criminals. And so it was all this very charged discourse around this. And I kind of wanted to clear that up and just show people that there is a need. People are desperate. Haiti is really, really in bad conditions right now. And there's a way for them to come here. You would just need people to sponsor them.
It was a really important piece. Thank you, Marcella. As always, it's great to talk to you. Really appreciate it.
Give our best to Santo.
Always. Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. Marcella Garcia is associate editor and a columnist for the Boston Globe. You should check out her stuff in the Globe. It's terrific stuff. Up next, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner will be with us to give us a judge's perspective on this week of waiting games on a Trump indictment that, you know, I don't know, is it ever going to happen? I'm beginning to lose faith completely. And also, we're going to talk about Jim's favorite topic, cameras in the courtroom Supreme Court. Listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're at the library tomorrow. The Attorney General will join us from 1 to 2. Andrea Campbell, take your questions and ours and that sort of thing. So here for another edition of On the Docket, where I'm sure Marjorie in about 10 seconds is going to say, what does it mean for an indictment to be imminent? In any case, we're joined, I'm interested in that too. We're joined now on Zoom by Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner is a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Judge Gertner. How are you?
Good. I'm good.
Hello, Judge Gertner. Well, it is clear that imminent was the wrong word to start using 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, whenever we started talking about the Manhattan DA indicting the president. But we talked earlier today with Chuck Todd. He's the host of Meet the Press, does the Toddcast, the podcast named The Toddcast. And he said that this case, Jim has said this actually too, seems to be the weakest, both legally and politically. I don't know that much of the nation is very surprised that Donald Trump might have wanted to cover up an affair. And Chuck Todd pointed out that we settled affairs and presidents back in the Bill Clinton days. So why are we even going there? But what do you think of the case? And do you think that this is even going to happen since some believe that Trump's lawyer went in there and said that Michael Cohen, one of the chief witnesses against Trump, was a big liar and that maybe the jury fell for this lawyer and there's going to be no indictment at all?
Let me start with the last question. This is now completely speculative on my part. Allowing Costello, Trump's lawyer, to testify, which is my understanding, it wasn't clear he had to brag, the district attorney had to do that. But by doing that, he's obviously enabling the jury to hear things that cast doubt on their own case. Now, it shouldn't have been a surprise that someone is going to say that Michael Cohen could conceivably be lying, because after all, Michael Cohen was convicted of perjury. So my speculation is that to some degree, Bragg does this to justify putting off, slowing down the train and really? Putting off the indictment process. This is completely speculation, because then let me get to your first and second questions. Both, even if this were a strong case concerning false recording of the payment to Stormy Daniels and false payment in connection with an election, you know, that the purpose of the payment was to make sure this didn't come out before the federal election, even if it were true factually and legally, strong factually and legally, it is in fact the weakest case of all the investigations against Donald Trump. The weakest, the less significant, and because you're talking about something which everyone knew about and happened years and years and years ago, is the most vulnerable to an argument of political pressure. In addition, it's actually the most complicated legally and factually.
Well, let me ask you one last question then here. We engage in irresponsible, uninformed speculation every day. Yours is relatively responsible and pretty informed. So were you, let's continue the it's speculation for a minute. You seem to be saying it's not impossible to believe that this imminent indictment may never happen, that Bragg may have been scared off.
Well, it's possible that he could have been scared off, because the notion that the testimony of Trump's lawyer Costello, not Trump's lawyer, Cohen's lawyer Costello, was a eureka moment seems to me to be ridiculous, yeah. Right? I mean, everyone knew whatever he is saying. I mean, of course, it matters that a witness is saying Michael Cohen told me something different before. But again, you didn't have to be a genius to say that Michael Cohen was a vulnerable witness. So I wonder if this was a contrived moment, you know, something to justify a delay. Having said that, we don't know the source of the information that an indictment was imminent. Everyone went crazy about it, but who knows whether that was linked from that was a leak from the Trump camp that things were imminent so that he could control the narrative.
That's essentially what Chuck Todd was suggesting this morning. So can we talk about one of those other cases that is stronger? Obviously, the three other investigations relate to the thing in Georgia. We've all heard the phone call to the Secretary of State. Can you go find me 11,000 votes? The insurrectionist investigation or activity around January 6th and Mar-a-Lago. There have been some advances or movement in the Mar-a-Lago thing, which I found to be stunning, actually. A judge yesterday ruled, well, actually an appellate court ruled on whether or not a lawyer for Trump could be forced to testify. You don't need to be a lawyer to know something about that attorney-client privilege thing, which is theoretically inviolate. But this, a judge and then a three-judge panel said, well, it's not always inviolate. And in this case, it will not be. The guy's going to have to testify. Explain to us, one, why, and two, how rare this so-called crime fraud exception thing is.
Well, let me start again with your second question. It's extremely okay. rare. Okay. It's extremely rare. So here's what a judge had to have found. He had to have found that Trump, former President Trump, was using his communications with his lawyer for the purpose of covering up a crime and not using it to get legal advice. Hey, Mr. Lawyer, what should I do in this case? But rather to use the lawyer's legal lawyer-client relationship for the purpose of covering up a crime. What was the crime with respect to Mar-a-Lago? The crime is that he knowingly had retained classified information on his premises. And so he's using, and so when you think about it, we were inferring that Trump knew what he was doing just from the timing of this, right? He leaves the White House. He's supposed to turn over. Apparently, Hirschman, who was one of his lawyers that testified before the January 6th committee.
Oh, loved him.
Yeah, right. He was the one who, you know, spoke in English. And
F-bombs in particular. Right.
But I mean, he was the one who testified that he told Trump, you got to return this stuff. It's really important. It's part of the presidential records. It's classified, et cetera. And then there was a letter. Then there was a subpoena. Then there was a visit. So one would have imagined, based on just the timeline, that Trump knew that there were documents that he was retaining that he shouldn't have. If he said to the lawyer, and I'm now speculating again, don't worry, I'll take care of this. You just say you've turned over everything. And he doesn't know one way or the other. Then you have Trump's intent right on the chopping block. In other words, you have Trump orchestrating the production or the non-production of these documents, which is necessary to the crime of willfully retaining classified information.
So to force this lawyer to testify, the judge and then judges on the appellate court have basically had to conclude that Trump engaged in criminal activity. Is that not what you're saying?
Well, it's a lower standard. It's more probable than not. So it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. They're saying there's enough evidence here to show that the client is using the lawyer not for legal advice and therefore subject to the protections of the privilege, but using the lawyer for the purpose of covering up a crime. But the standard is relatively low. So they're not necessarily predicting that he will be indicted or even predicting that he will be convicted. But it's an important, I don't want to say devastating, but it's certainly a significant move. And the other thing is, what's significant is that the Court of Appeals, you know, took a very short time to make its decision, which is extraordinary. Because one of the other things we've seen in this litigation is that the former president wants to delay and delay and delay so that all of these prosecutions back up against the election.
Of course.
Court of Appeals was not going to allow that.
We're talking to former federal judge Nancy Gertner. You know, we just got a text message, and I think a lot of people are confused about this, why the district attorney would allow Costello to testify, the old line about how a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich, and why they would knowingly bring in someone who would refute the case they'd already built. So why?
Well, I think there is an issue in New York law, which I'm not familiar with, which required them to ask Trump to give him an opportunity to testify. That's not the case across the country. I don't know whether, I mean, typically the grand jury does not hear exculpatory evidence,
right.
Evidence that would exonerate or potentially exonerate a defendant. So I don't know. I don't think that that's a unique issue of New York law, but it could well be. Assuming Bragg had the discretion to allow this, one can imagine he was going to do it for two reasons. One would be to make it clear that he was being as fair as humanly possible. And we've seen that in a lot of the litigation involving the former president, judges bending over backwards to give him, frankly, due process that other litigants never get. And so that's one thing, he's bending over backwards. And the other would be if there's a New York law issue here. And the third would be, as I said a moment ago, whoever leaked the imminent indictment story, certainly D.A. Bragg has seen the incredible pushback. And this could have been a contrivance to say, well, whoa, we'll slow this down.
Let me tell you what I've heard. I'm not a former federal judge, but I read the New York Times. It's not the law. The law is what you said, that the you have to invite the targeted individual, Trump, to testify, obviously declined. It's a variation, at least according to the analysts I read, of your first, this fairness thing. It's not so much to be fair. It's to take away the unfairness argument from Trump. They said I could testify. I'm not going to testify on a witch hunt. But I had a lawyer who could expose the lies of Michael Cohen. And what I suggested this lawyer was willing to voluntarily testify. The DA, of course, in a witch hunt said no. So I think it was primarily to take away yet another, not that Trump doesn't have other things in his arsenal, that argument from Trump. They don't want to hear the truth. So
right. When you think about it, as I said a moment ago, this testimony is not a surprise. It shouldn't have been a surprise to the grand jury. In fact, Cohen had told a different story before feds came calling. This was not a great surprise. And so one can imagine that it's one to take away an argument from Trump and two to slow down the process.
Yeah.
Seeing what the pushback has been to slow down the process.
We're talking
That's
to judge.
My speculation.
We're talking to former federal judge Nancy Gertner.
So one of my favorite stories is the Dominion lawsuit against Fox News, because I'm hoping, I must admit, that Dominion prevails in that lawsuit against Fox News. I don't like it when people can get away with telling lies that they know are lies when they say them. But anyway, the story today that I mentioned from Washington Post, this Judge Eric Davis, is cast doubt on the assertion of Fox lawyers that their hosts, Gene Pirro, Sean Hannity, were just expressing opinions and not asserting facts when they talked about the Dominion machines having been subpar, and the reason that, or one of the main reasons why Joe Biden lost the election. So I'm hoping, Judge Gertner, that what we know so far in this case is pretty damning to Fox. It's very hard to win these kinds of cases, but I don't know. This looks like almost a slam dunk to me, but maybe I'm too hopeful too soon.
Dominion is actually doing something very interesting here. Dominion could wait for a trial, a jury trial, in which they would show the kinds of things that are, you know, the kinds of text messages that we've seen where Fox hosts are saying essentially, I know that, Sidney Powell isn't telling the truth, but I'm going to say it on the air anyhow. They could have a trial. They would do that version. And then the other side would say, these are opinions. These were not presented as facts. And if they're opinions, they can't be the subject. They're obviously opinions. They can't be the subject of a defamation suit. Dominion chose to move for summary judgment. Let me give you 2 minutes of weeds for a moment. Moving for summary judgment is where you lay out your facts. Let's say the defendant here, Dominion, lays out the facts and says to the judge, there's no way a reasonable jury could conclude that these words were opinion rather than a statement of fact. There's no way. And it's costless for them to do that, because if the judge says actually there a jury could see it in either way, then you just go on to a jury trial. But by laying this out now, sort of what they're doing is putting all the facts on the record. In a jury trial, all of this would have been buried in a trial, right? You mm-hmm. would hear it and cover it, but now it's out, laid out on the record. And what the judge's comments suggested is that he was saying, essentially, no one could listen to these statements, Pirro, Hannity, and not conclude that they were endorsing the underlying facts as true. No one could listen to that. But Dominion is, litigating this case for all of us. I mean, very publicly, didn't have to do it this way. And the judge seemed to be saying, no, the standard is no reasonable jury could take these statements as statements of facts. And he's saying, actually, I think a reasonable jury could conclude they were statements of fact. And that would be leaning to summary judgment, which would end the case without a jury trial.
Well, speaking of that for a second, just a very quick question about the jury, assuming this does go to a jury trial. There's always a question for, I was going to say us lay people, even though I am theoretically a lawyer, about what is the threshold for a juror to be struck? If someone during the voir dire were to say to the judge does the voir dire in a federal trial, right? Not the lawyers.
Yes, but not in every, yeah.
Okay, so if the prospective juror, if this goes to a jury, says I'm a big fan of Fox News, I'm a big fan of Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, and Sean Hannity, but I can totally judge this fairly, would he or she be allowed to stay on that jury? I know it's not an absolute. Would they be allowed to stay on the jury?
Different judges are different. And
what would you do?
Me, I would not. I would have excluded them. But my threshold for considering these are challenges for cause, a biased juror was different than other judges.
Okay.
But typically, a judge will ask the following question. And most jurors who want to be conform, you know, who want to sort of give it the right answer to the judge, sure, would say yes. So the judge would say, you're a fan of Fox News, but surely you can set that aside for the purposes of, you know, being a fair juror in this case. And most people, understanding that the question is calling for an answer of yes, I can, will say yes, I can. And most judges would accept that. So yes, it's that could be, I mean, a juror that sort of gives assurances of their fairness could get on, notwithstanding their being in love with Hannity or Pirro.
Okay. So,
now, by the way, okay, that, by the way, that's something I've always wondered about. When you try cases and you had the voir dire and the jurors were asked their questions and some people maybe weren't really telling the truth, has that ever been a problem for you where someone did turn out to be very biased beforehand in the case and they wreaked havoc in the jury room afterwards? Or do people generally be honest? Are they truthful in those voir dires?
Well, wreaking havoc in a court, in the jury room, is one thing. You can wind up with someone who is, you know, just being sort of not collegial in a setting that requires collegiality. So that's one thing. But no, I never had a situation where I understood that a juror was not telling the truth. I found out after the deliberation that the juror was not telling the truth.
Yeah.
Part of that is from my experience as a lawyer, as a trial lawyer, I understood, I believed very strongly in a very robust, careful voir dire.
Yeah.
So I would sometimes let lawyers ask questions. And in criminal cases, I almost always allowed individual questioning in my lobby, in my private area, with all the parties, you know, and the potential juror. So I don't know whether the way I approached it led to fewer problems, but certainly I didn't have many problems.
Well, isn't one of the basis for appeals of the death penalty in the Tsarnaev case that at least one, if not two, mm-hmm, jurors misrepresented their opinions about Tsarnaev's guilt before the...
Yeah.
During the voir dire, right?
It was more than that. It was more than I mean, what they did is, and this is a problem, going to be a problem going forward in a social media world. One said, I'm not on social media. I've never expressed an opinion about Tsarnaev. And then it came out that, in fact, she had expressed opinions on social media about Tsarnaev, I mean, describing him, you know, in malevolent terms. Wow. And then the second juror also said he wasn't on social media, or words to that effect. I don't remember the exact words. And then it turns out he was on an email string in which friends said, hey, get on the jury, and then essentially kill the guy. Again, I'm characterizing.
I understand. So,
but the Court of Appeals has that now. But judges are rarely overturned for their decisions they make on voir dire. Rarely overturned.
Judge Gertner, I'm sorry.
That's why there's a whole range of things that judges do at the on voir dire, because they're rarely overturned for what they do.
So one of my pet causes, I don't know if I've ever discussed this with you, and I'm almost nervous to bring it up, because if you disagree with me, I'm going to be heartbroken. So be careful where you tread here. One of my pet causes is cameras in the courtroom. And I think most people know there are cameras in every state courtroom in America. There are cameras in virtually no federal courtrooms. And that includes the Supreme Court, which finally allowed audio recording of a broadcast of what they're doing. Chuck Grassley, who's about 140 from Iowa, he's actually 88, who I don't have much good to say about, but he is the champion of this camera in the courtroom thing. He's joined by Dick Durbin, obviously a leading Democrat. They've refiled this bill to allow there to be televising of Supreme Court. So there's no jury issue, no affecting of a jury or performance by a lawyer, all the crap that I think has been under undercut the arguments against.
Is that a legal term, crap?
Yes, undercut by the experience in the state court, which seems to be quite fine to me. But because of this, we don't get to see things like the Tsarnaev trial, for example. But this is just the Supreme Court.
Or
and
Billy Bulger, Whitey Bulger's trial.
Whitey Bulger, exactly.
Sal Benacy's trial.
This is just the Supreme Court. Two guys wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying the results of some research show that cameras can as easily harm the court's legitimacy as help it. And my conclusion is, even if that is true, the public has a right. These are public courtrooms. If you can't go to the courtroom, you have a right to see what's going on in the courtroom. And if it unfortunately affects the legitimacy, so be it. I hope it doesn't. I hope it increases the legitimacy. But regardless, I shouldn't be making the arguments. Where are you on camera? And by the way, one more thing. I think Kagan's a friend of yours, isn't she?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So Kagan, who was former dean of Harvard Law School, and Sotomayor both testify in their confirmation hearings that they're open to cameras in the courtroom. And as soon as they get on the court, they're not crazy about cameras in the courtroom, which drives me nuts. But that's another topic. Where are you on cameras? Forgetting the courtrooms in general, on the Supreme Court to start with.
Jim, this is a situation where I'll make your day. I've been in favor of cameras in the courtroom from the beginning, from the time I was on the bench, from the time I was a lawyer, obviously, because I practiced in state court, and state courts had crimes and trials that were much more compelling and you know, dangerous, arguably, you know, rape and murder. And the Republic didn't fall when they were these were televised. In fact, in a moment of complete narcissism, I want you to know that I have a tape of every time I've ever been on television from 1972
wow.
until now. Total narcissism.
I saw you last night.
Wait, including on my show, by the way, I hope?
Yes, yes, everything. I would be, if someone asked me to go on television, I would call my husband and say, stick in the VHS immediately. And so I have VHS tapes, I have beta
What's
tapes.
What's a VHS? Exactly.
Right. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So I've always been in favor of it. Now, and I testified as a judge when I was a judge.
Oh.
I testified in favor of Grassley's bill. And I don't remember the Democrat coordinating that. And I have that tape as well, if you want it. But I would testify in favor of that against the Judicial Conference of the United States. So there would be me on the
That's
side of
great.
The only judge and then the Judicial Conference of the United States. I think that the answer to the Supreme Court is if aggressive questioning, this is what this article said, aggressive questioning could undermine the legitimacy of the court. And if therefore judges temper their presentations because they know the public is watching, then that's not a bad thing.
Hmm.
It's not a bad thing. In other words, judges should be aware of how they are being seen.
Yeah.
Right? Dress a certain way, you speak a certain way because it's within the judicial role. Would it impact, does it impact their actual decision-making if they can't perform for the cameras? It obviously won't impact their decision-making. That's an illusion. The other thing that's interesting is that there has been considered more performance for the cameras in this time of deeply divided legal issues than we've ever had before. I mean, I would like someone to do a study about whether or not, you know, you're seeing just much more performative mm-hmm. gestures on the Supreme Court because it's been a much more contested institution than it had ever been, at least publicly. So if the public performance is tempered by the fact that you want to look, is tempered, whatever, by the fact that there are cameras, that's fine. Judges know the difference between playing for the cameras and your decision making, right? And so if you don't play for the cameras during your oral arguments, it's not going to affect a judge's decision behind closed doors, especially not this court that is prepared to just about undo precedent over the past 50 years without consequence. So I can't imagine it would make a difference.
Just one last thing. I think also for regular people to see a trial in action is an edifying experience. I think for the moment, I mean, there can be abuses and there can be some crazy defense lawyer.
We should see that too.
Incompetent DA or something. But for the most part, it kind of restores your faith in the judicial system, which I think would be a good thing.
I think that's right. And an oral argument before a court of appeals and a Supreme Court is different than a trial. You're supposed to be seeing rational questions and rational arguments on both sides. So it should be the best version of a judicial proceeding. A trial, oral arguments closing arguments can be sometimes strident, but an argument before a court of appeals should be the best version. Supreme Judicial Court arguments, our Massachusetts High Court, are public. And I think more is, that's to the good. Judges, there was a security issue at one point, which is you don't necessarily want justices' faces all over the country. But these justices now are much more engaged in the world.
They're online, too.
They're online. They're writing books. They're giving speeches.
There's no argument against
it. Security issue is less.
And they don't show the jurors most of the time, right?
They will not. They do not.
Right. And that's a different issue.
Totally.
The notion that Supreme Court justices should be responsible to the public in the way that they can, they conduct oral argument, I think is clear.
So can you tell Justice Kagan when you have coffee with her, I want to talk to her. Can you do that?
I'll see what I can do.
Thank you. Judge Gertner, as always, our pleasure. Thank you
very
so much,
much
for your time. Be well.
Judge Gertner, we've been speaking with Nancy Gertner. I know you'd be happy about that,
very
Jim.
Happy.
She's a retired federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, BPR contributor. We're very pleased that you could spend some time with us today, Judge Gertner. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7. Up next, we're going to talk to Eric Deggans. He's NPR's TV critic. We're going to talk to him about season 4 of Succession. We're going to talk to him about season 3 of Ted Lasso, some other things about television that you don't want to miss. Eric Deggans is next. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow, and as I've said a few times today, slight change. The Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, will join us, but from 1 to 2 for Ask the AG. We're joined now on Zoom by Eric Deggans. Eric's NPR's TV critic, contributor to NBC, MSNBC, and BPR, and he's the author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Eric, it's good to see you.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Great.
Yeah, thank you very much, Eric. So the season 4 of Succession, which everybody seems to be crazy about, is back. I don't know if they're going to be, since it's supposed to be loosely based on the Murdochs, if they're going to be sued by a voting machine company this time.
I can confirm that does not happen in the episodes that I saw.
But what do you think? Is it living up? Is it as good as the other three? It is.
Yeah, it's really good. So there's a narrative momentum that comes to a series when it realizes that it is powering towards an end. And so one of the things that, the question that you always had about Succession is that there was this sort of balance between efforts. But, this is the story of a family-owned media company. A Rupert Murdoch-like mogul sits at the top of it. His name is Logan Roy. He's played by Brian Cox, and then he has 4 children, one who is older and kind of out of the business, and 3 who are younger, all adults who worked in the business, but by the end of the last season had sort of united in opposition against their father, who tweaked his divorce settlement so that he could remove their ability to affect the sale of his company. So as this new season opens, the 3 siblings who are united are working together and they're in opposition to their father. Now, you would think that there's always a situation where the father is the more serious one, the more capable one. He always figures out a way to manipulate the kids so that he comes out on top. After a while, that would seem to get tiresome. So having an ending for this story really helps Succession to bring some really big swings. We see some really big events coming in the first 4 episodes. I will not say what they are because they're tremendous spoilers, but they change the dynamics of the family in really significant ways. And it freshens up the story in a way that's really interesting. And I also feel like the tone of the show is so delicate. It's this black comedy, On the surface, it seems like a drama, but it, you know, there's little barbs and jokes and dry humor through every scene. And I feel like every season they refine that tone and they get it sharper and they nail it even better. And so in this fourth season, they do a really good job of setting you up with these dry barbs and jabs where each, you know, dysfunctional character is bouncing off each other. And then in the quiet moments, you see them kind of react to what's happened. And that's where you get the drama.
So, I'm vibrating with excitement, I should say.
It's really well done. It's really well done. And I'll say the third episode is a pivotal episode. So the first episode is great. That's the one we're going to see on Sunday.
Yeah.
But the third episode in this new season is pivotal. And we see some of the best acting. I mean, this is already one of TV's best ensembles, but we see some of the best acting on the show in that episode. So don't miss that if you're a fan.
So here's just a clip from the trailer for season four. And as we, I think for those who haven't seen it, you know enough to know it's a show about horrible people doing horrible things. Here it is.
I love you. But you are not serious people.
I have it on good authority. There is a kill list.
Ken, is your head on straight?
We've been schooled by a barbarian that goes by the name Logan Roy.
I mean, he's out of control.
You know, Eric, I was thinking about this morning in anticipation of talking to you.
Yeah.
And as someone who's watched television my whole life, as I assume everybody listening has, when did it become okay to have a series that had no likable character in it? No, I'm serious. We always used to believe, I think, you correct me as a TV historian if I'm wrong, you had to have somebody who was a hero, somebody you liked amid the sea of evil and horribleness. There's,
You know, I will grant you that there was a time in television where the people who made television thought that. Mm-hmm. But I have always felt, especially in modern times, like, you know, the 70s really changed storytelling in film and TV in important ways. The 70s gave us All in the Family, for example.
Yeah.
And Archie Bunker comes along. And this is a character who is the center of the story, but is also the butt of the joke. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of the series anti-hero. He's a bigot. He's not as smart as he thinks he is. He takes advantage of his wife. He doesn't appreciate his daughter or his son-in-law. There is something good at the heart of Archie, but there's a lot of reprehensible elements to that character. And yet, people really identified with him. CBS did a poll where 30% of the people they polled thought he was the hero of the show. So they did a good job of humanizing him. And I think it's important to have characters who you care about, and it's important to have characters that who you want to see what happens to them.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they have to be nice. That doesn't mean they have to be likable. And in fact, if they're not likable, that can help you because it's compelling to be drawn to a character who is not likable. And so what works, I think, in Succession is that, especially with the character Kendall Roy, who's played by Jeremy Strong, you get the sense that there's a good guy in there struggling to get out. and he is constantly getting in his own way, and he is stuck in this dysfunctional family that doesn't value him, and he's stuck with his father who manipulates him and takes advantage of him. And one of the things that I think Succession has gotten good at is there are moments where you see the humanity of every character. You see, you know, Connor, the oldest character played by Alan Ruck, the oldest child of Logan Roy, who desperately wants love but can't admit that he wants love. Siobhan, Shiv Roy, the only woman, she is in this marriage and she takes her husband for granted and constantly acts like she doesn't want to be married. But in this fourth season, you see that there is something there. There's a bond between those two people that she is scared to walk away from. Every one of these characters sort of reveals their humanity in small moments. And that keeps you engaged with them because they're not monsters. They're people. They're horribly damaged people, but they are people.
Sort of like Walter White. And speaking of Walter White, Bob Odenkirk. We were introduced to Bob Odenkirk, obviously, on
Now, that is a professional. That is a radio professional, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
That was one heck of a transition, my friend.
Exactly. So Bob Odenkirk, we met him there, and then obviously Better Call Saul was also totally fabulous. There's a new thing called Lucky Hank. He's a professor at some small school. Here's a little clip from, whoops, where is Lucky, the clip from
it's
Lucky Hank?
Top of page two.
Oh, here he is. Thank you very much. In this clip, you'll hear Odenkirk explaining to one of his creative writing students with some frustration why he will not be the next Chaucer.
You're here. You're here. And even if your presence at this middling college in this sad, forgotten town was some bizarre anomaly, and you do have the promise of genius, which I'll bet a kidney that you don't, it will never surface. I am not a good enough writer or writing teacher to bring it out of you. And how do I know that? How? Because I, too, am here at Railton College, mediocrity's capital.
That is one hell of a soundbite. So tell us a little more.
This is something we can all relate to.
That is so awesome. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever seen that TV show, The Newsroom, that Aaron Sorkin did.
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah.
But there's like a speech that the lead character gives in first episode that is like the mission statement of the show.
Yes.
And this speech is the mission statement for Lucky Hank, right? This guy is on the verge of a midlife crisis. He's the head of the English department, a seriously dysfunctional department with seriously dysfunctional colleagues at a seriously mediocre college in a seriously mediocre town in Pennsylvania. The college is fictional. His big problem, as we come to know, I've seen four episodes of this, is that he's painfully honest about what he's going through and about how everything around him is lacking. And so he did, you know, that whole speech started because he was in a class with a student who was reading this terrible story, and it looked like he wasn't paying attention. The teacher wasn't paying attention. And when the student called him on it, he proceeded to list all the reasons why the story was terrible. And then he went into that soliloquy about how they are trapped in the monument to mediocrity that is Railton College.
Love it.
So if you've ever worked in academia, you can sympathize because this TV series really does portray all the frustrations and limitations of academia. And on top of it, you have Bob Odenkirk, who I said in my review is he gives virtuoso performances as the annoyed every guy. Mm-hmm. So, and you heard it in that speech right there. It's a really wonderful. See, it's not as big and bold and transformational as Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, but it is a very good series, and it is surprising that he went from one amazing series in Better Call Saul to another very good series on AMC playing this character.
You know, I read a short story sometime, and I can't remember who wrote it, but the main thrust of it is the tragedy of realizing you have a little bit of talent. Mm-hmm. And that's what this reminds me of. And it was always a debate. Yes. Are you better off knowing that you just have a little bit of talent and then, you know, cutting your losses, or better off not knowing and then going on to make a fool of yourself? I don't know.
Well, the curse is to have a little bit of talent and want more, which is what this character is.
Yeah.
And the character wrote a really well-regarded novel when he was younger, I think about 20 years ago. But his father is a highly accomplished novelist and professor who abandoned him and his mother when he was younger. And so he's had a chip on his shoulder about his father abandoning him. He's had writer's block since the first novel, which, again, a lot of us who are in the writing life can relate to. There's a lot about sort of being at midlife and being at a crossroads and trying to figure out the way forward for yourself, and being honest with yourself and the people around you while also trying to figure out how to get through every day. That is really, and on top of it, as you can tell, it's funny. You know, they figured out a way to wring humor out of what sounds like a really depressing story, I admit. But it's really well done, and it's worth a look.
Do you remember, either of you, when I think it was Nixon who nominated this guy Carswell to the Supreme Court, who obviously never made it, and people were criticizing him as like he's really not that good? And either Nixon or Carswell himself the response was said something like, "There's a place for mediocrity on the Supreme Court." So I got that mostly
what a,
right.
What a though. Selling point! I love. Oh, God. I'm mediocre, but there's got to be some room for me there. There's some room for
mediocrity. We're talking to Eric Deggans. He is NPR's TV critic. So let's talk now about, I guess, a show that's known for its unending uplift. The third season of Ted Lasso is basking in the glow, apparently. Third season around of all its quirky characters. So what's the deal here, Eric?
Yeah, so Ted Lasso. Now, this third season, there's some question about whether or not it will be the final season of the show. Jason Sudeikis, who's the star, he plays Ted Lasso, this American college football coach who was hired to coach a British soccer team. We find out in the first season that he was hired because the woman who owns the team got it from her divorced ex-husband, and she wanted to destroy it. So she figured the best way to do that would be to hire an American who didn't know anything about soccer and hire him to run the team. But his optimism and his approach to life wound up saving the day, saving the team, saving the woman, saving this little quirky family of characters. Now, in the third season, Jason Sudeikis, who's the star and an executive producer and co-creator of the show, said that this third season tells all the stories that he wanted to tell about Ted Lasso and this team. So there's some question about whether they're going to go forward. Apple TV Plus has very pointedly not said that this is the end of the show, because it's their most successful show, both in terms of critical acclaim and awards, and probably in viewership. So as this third season begins, Ted is questioning why he's still in Britain. The team is trying to win a championship, a major championship. And technically that's why he's still there. He wants to get them to win a major championship before he considers going back home. But he has an ex-wife and he has a son that they're co-parenting, and he's feeling sort of cut off from them. And basically this season, a lot of it is about regret. The different characters have made decisions that they are coming to regret. You know, Ted had an assistant who decided to leave the team and go coach a rival team. And, you know, we're seeing moments where that guy is vacillating between regretting that choice and leaning into being a jerk, which is what the owner of that that team that he joined, who just happens to be the ex-husband of the woman who owns Ted Lasso's team, you know, the guy who owns that team wants him to be a jerk, so he's leaning into that, but he's also conflicted about it. There's a lot of great character work here, and people who love these characters will enjoy this third season, because you really spend, you kind of luxuriate in their quirkiness. The episodes are longer. They're 43 to 50 minutes long, the first four episodes that I saw. And so you get to spend more time with these characters, yeah, bouncing off each other. And there's even some new ones that they introduce. So if you like the characters and you like seeing them bounce off each other and you enjoy it, if you expect Ted Lasso to be about something, if you wanted to communicate these higher mores or this higher message, you might be a little disappointed, because it is kind of recreating what a lot of fans loved about the show. But it seems to be powering towards an end, and we, you know, we're only starting to get a sense of what that is in the first four episodes.
And by the way, good for the whole cast. They went to the White House the other day to talk about mental health stuff, which I think is really an important contribution.
Get a little clip, Jim.
So can we, we're short on time. Can we skip the clip and go to what I really want to talk about, which is the future of The Daily Show? Trevor Noah's coming to town at the Wilbur in early April, and you know, everybody is wild about this.
He's finally making that stand-up comic money.
Yeah, exactly. The tickets, by the way, I just checked as you were talking to Marjorie, $200-$300 a pop, which is really, it's serious.
That's list price, right? That's what you pay.
Right, it's not even the secondary market thing. So, I think there have been nine fill-in hosts, and you rated them, ranked them after only five, and put Leslie Jones as the number one. And we want to play a clip that had particularly meaning to us. We broadcast live from the dedication of the Embrace, the great monument. Here is what Leslie Jones, talking to Dulce Sloan, had to say about the Embrace Memorial on the Common. Here it is.
Maybe it's just a matter of time. Maybe it's just a matter of time. In time, we will see this statue for what it truly is. Martin Luther King going down on his wife. I cannot see it!
which way you look at it, it's a different erotic act, right? It's like a sexual Rubik's Cube.
So we're now at 9. I think the most recent was Al Franken.
Now tell me you weren't thinking that when you first saw it, too.
Well, I have to know. As a matter of fact, until people went online later that day, we did not think of it. We love it, by the way. We think it's great.
Okay. Leslie told me, as a white person, I should shut up. So I'm shutting up.
So, Eric, two things. One, you ranked, as I said, when there are only 5 fill-ins so far, you ranked Jones first. We're interested to say, after Franken, who I think was 9th, you still rank her. One, and two, there was a piece in the New York Times, which I'm sure you saw by somebody, Jason somebody or other, whatever it is, saying, hey, why not a la SNL just keep rotating fill-in hosts, never pick a permanent host? So give us your thoughts on both, if you would.
Yeah, you know, that's an intriguing idea. I guess, you know, part of me sort of feels for the staff of The Daily Show, you know, trying to figure out the sensibilities of a new host every week and wrap the show around them is really hard. And if you're Saturday Night Live nerds, you know that the process of making that show is brutal. And people work until 2 and 3 in the morning, several nights a week, trying to pull together shows around a different guest host every week. So that might be something that's kind of difficult for Daily Show staff. But I understand the appeal, because part of the problem the Daily Show has is that there's a lot of shows out there that do what it does, and have taken elements of what it does and maybe perfected those elements. So, you know, the New York Times piece pointed out that Seth Meyers, for example, deconstructs the news in a way that's maybe even might even be a little better than what The Daily Show did, even though clearly what Jon Stewart was doing on The Daily Show inspired what Seth Meyers is doing now. So all of that said, Leslie Jones would still be towards the top of my list. I think Hasan Minhaj did a great job. And I think Cal Penn also did a great job. And Cal Penn got an interview with President Biden because he had once worked in the Obama White House. So that to me, when you see a guest host bringing something of themselves and bringing their connections and bringing their passions to the guest hosting gig, that's when it goes really well. That's why I like Leslie Jones. She was obviously like super excited to do it and was bringing a lot of the things that she cared about to the discussions that they were having. And it was interesting because, you know, you can tell she's not somebody who necessarily reads the New York Times cover to cover, but she's smart and she has an instinct about what's funny. And she has these causes out in the world that she really cares about that she wanted to talk about. And I think in a lot of ways that can be better than somebody who might be, you know, more steeped in the news. Like, you know, Al Franken, I thought has done a pretty decent job. But number one, you can tell he's kind of rusty. You know, it's not like he's performing every day. And also, you know, I just get the sense that, you know, I know a lot about what he thinks about politics because he was an elected official for a long time. You know, it was more interesting to see Cal Penn talk about working in the Obama White House, something, you know, he told a lot of stories I hadn't heard before, or seeing Leslie Jones reveal a side of herself where she's talking about issues and social movements in a way that you didn't even really get to see her talk about when she was on Saturday Night Live or in her stand-up. So I think it's a good point to say that maybe it'd be nice to see a rotation of performers reveal themselves again and again. I want to see how the correspondents do. We haven't yet seen the correspondents serve as guest hosts, but we are told... we've been told by Comedy Central that they are going to be allowed to. So I want to see what they do. I'm a big fan of Roy Wood Jr. And, you know, I really want to see what he does with the show in particular. But all those correspondents are really great. And one of the good things, I think, about this guest host situation is the correspondents have been able to step up more. And we've been able to see more of them. And I would love to I wouldn't want to make a decision about rotating guest hosts until we get to see the correspondents actually show their stuff and see what they can do.
I think they should try out Logan Roy, too, for a little edginess as a host.
Yeah.
This is a possibility. Hey, Eric, as always, it's great to spend time with you. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And for the pre-show advice, I appreciate that, too. Eric Deggans is an NPR TV critic. His latest book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Thanks so much, Eric. Appreciate it.
See you soon. See you soon.
Always fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, coming up next, a new survey has come out talking about what is the happiest country on earth. Well, we're not in the top 10. We squeeze into the top 20. We're going to tell you about who's happiest, why they're happiest, and why we're not so happy. That is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, a reminder yet again, we're at the library tomorrow with the Attorney General joining us to take your questions from 1 to 2.
Excuse me. I forgot to say who we were just talking to when I did the out.
Who were we talking to?
We were talking to Eric Deggans. He's NPR's TV critic. Yes, I just
He's
want
great,
people to know.
I love talking
He's great,
to him.
And I forgot to say it. So excuse me. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, that's really horrible.
I know.
So closing out the show, we're talking once more about happiness or lack of it here in the U.S. A new report, it comes out annually, I think, from the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, identifies the happiest countries on earth and the least happy. America did not take the number one spot. That went to Finland. In fact, I think five of the six top happy countries are Nordic countries.
Nordic countries.
Finland was number one 6 years in a row. We did crack the top 20. Americans are apparently the 50th happiest citizens.
15th.
I'm sorry. 15th, which ain't much considering we're the wealthiest, too. So give us a call at 877-301-8970. What would knock us up a couple of pegs in your view? Or is do you have a desire to move to one of the happiest countries like Finland and Sweden and all those Nordic countries? And if you don't want to move but would like this, us to see us move up higher than 15th, what would make you happier? A Trump perp walk, Medicare for all on the other end of the spectrum, no limits on a gun ownership? What would make you happier so that America as a whole could move farther up the scale? And why do you think we're only 15th in light of the fact that we are, as I say, the wealthiest country in the world? 877-301-8970.
Israel, surprisingly, because there's
a lot
of unrest in Israel, they're number four. But what they say about these Nordic countries, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Norway, in this survey, is that they score very well on measures that they use to find out if you're happy in your life.
Mm-hmm.
First one is life expectancy. We're not that great on life expectancy anymore. Gross GDP per capita is not as good among whole swaths of – we have a huge poverty problem in the United States. Social support, I mean, we're pretty low on that, right? We certainly don't have a support when it comes to –
huge government support. High taxes, too, but huge government support in those countries.
Yeah, they don't have to worry about getting sick. They don't have to worry about getting old. They don't have to worry about all these things. We're basically on our own for a lot of these situations.
Don't have to worry about a former president going to jail. They
That's
don't have
right.
to worry about any
well,
of those
things. Well, low corruption. You know,
is that one of them?
Yes. And I think we thought for a long time that we had low corruption in the United States. I mean, we do compared to some other countries, obviously. But I think there's a growing sense that we are more and more corrupt. I think we've certainly thought that in the last few years.
Yeah.
And then generosity in a community where people look after each other. It was interesting. They said that our happiness in most of these countries did not necessarily decline during the pandemic.
I know, it's
and one of the theories is because people were helping each other, that people were coming together. And the bottom of the list of places you wouldn't be surprised, like Afghanistan, I mean, and unrest there constantly. Lebanon, unrest there. Remember that huge apartment explosion a few years ago?
You know what's
ago,
not
right
at the bottom? Ukraine is not at the bottom.
It's
like
not.
90th or something.
It's 92nd.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, considering what's going on there. Russia is ahead of them at 70.
Yeah.
But there's
because
they
don't know whether they're happier.
Well, they're higher now than they were in 2014. That's when there was the annexation by the Russians of that
Crimea.
Part of that part of Ukraine. Now they've moved up somewhat, the theory is, because they have a stronger sense of common purpose.
Right, invading other countries makes people really happy in Russia.
fighting against that invasion apparently is making people happier despite the terrible tragedy that they're going through.
Are you talking about Ukraine now? I was talking about Russia.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. In any case, we have almost no time, like always, because we don't know how to count time on the clock. And our apologies. We're going to do better in the future. I don't know how this happens. But in any case, 877-301-8970. Any reflection on us being only 15th and what would make you want us, what would make you feel that we deserve in the higher upper echelons of happiness? Let's go to Rhode Island with Phoebe. Hey.
Hey, how are you?
Quite happy actually today. Thank you.
So when I think about this topic, I wonder about the connection between being satisfied and being happy, and whether or not some of the countries, not that they expect less out of life, but they are more easily satisfied with what they have. And Americans are just never satisfied. And it's got to be more, more, and bigger, bigger. And I don't know. That's kind of what I thought.
That's an interesting observation. I don't know what the answer is, but that's a good observation, Phoebe. Thanks.
I think it has to do with social safety nets.
I think
and
it is, too.
People are constantly worried about how they're going to pay the rent, how they're going to pay their mortgage if they can ever buy a house, how they're going to pay for college, how they're going to pay for health care.
Not everybody has health care, and those who have health care have crappy health care, and that matters a lot to people. And by the way, they're universal coverage in all those
countries.
In all those democracies, but particularly in these Nordic countries we were talking about.
And I think you worry about what's going to happen to you when you get old. I mean, if you can't, if you're two paychecks away from devastation in your 40s, what are you going to do when you're in your 80s?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a pretty picture in some of these.
Except in this country, I mean, with Medicare, other than the fact you have no teeth, you could be quite
and you can't,
happy.
And you can't hear,
see.
And you can't
no,
see.
I think you have, some.
They're overrated, Jim.
No, they
let's
are.
Face it. Teeth, hearing, and seeing.
Teeth.
Overrated.
Yeah.
Overrated.
Yeah, I think we do put too much emphasis on teeth in this country. For those who don't know, we learned this from Bernie Sanders. We don't cover Medicare. Incredibly, does not cover dental or vision care,
which
is just stunning to me.
But didn't Elizabeth Warren get those cheaper hearing aids?
She did actually. Non-prescription brought down the prices dramatically.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good. And if you're over, if you're on Medicare, you can get insulin for $35.
Yeah.
You don't have to do what the 40s and 50 year olds do, which is take a little bit every day, less than they're supposed to. Because
unfortunately, you can't eat your dinner, but you can have insulin for $35.
I think we've
unless it's liquid.
I think we've nailed the problem here in the United States.
Tom in a car.
You're on your own.
Tom, sink or swim. Tom in a car. What's your deal?
Hi.
Tom, say something. Hi.
Oh, hi. I didn't know I was going to go live. I already talked to somebody, but
no, that was not the show. That was our colleague. That was like
just to make sure I'm not a whack job, right?
Well, I'll decide
that's
that.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think in this I'm 60.
Yeah.
I think in this country, we still equate happiness and success with income and look
this
what I got,
good.
Look what you don't got.
I like this.
You know?
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, I say that because I can remember in a specific example, I was on vacation in Costa Rica. I was on the tourist raft trip, and we were going down a river, and I saw people in little shacks that were made from corrugated metal and plywood and you know, bits and pieces here and there, waving to us on the shore, and they're clearly, not high income families, but they were all smiling and waving, and they were all together. They were happy. They had what a lot of us want and can't buy.
Yeah, I would assume they'd prefer not to live in a metal shack on the side of the river, though. Tom, would you not agree?
I would probably agree because I'm an architect. But
there you go.
I don't know if that's just me because my background
and
my upbringing in the United States, you know?
By the way, Tom, in answer to your question, you are not a total whack job. So we were glad you were on the show. And that, I think equating happiness. No, he's not. Equating happiness with money almost exclusively in this country for lots of people. I think Tom's on to something, too. Tom, thanks for the call.
A lot of people are talking about health care problems. We need universal health care. We need not to be worried that if we're going to get sick, we're going to be bankrupt.
We're joking, by the way. I don't know what why the results were what they were. I am totally convinced insecurity about the ability to pay for health care is a huge, and that it's there when you need it is a huge part of the problem.
Yeah,
in this country,
inability to pay for almost anything, I think, unless you're wealthy in America. Chris in Hudson, thank you for calling.
Hey, Chris, what's up?
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call.
Yep.
I have to say that last caller was definitely onto something.
He was.
Equating success with happiness.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, from my perspective here, I've got two kids under four. Yeah. If we had stronger parental leave policies, like federally instituted, it would make a huge difference in the quality of life for Americans as a whole. Mm.
Well, that's the social safety net thing, Chris, we're talking about. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, they do pay very high taxes, higher than we do here, to get what they get. But you wouldn't be making the same call if you lived in Finland. Chris, thanks.
I think in one of these countries, and I'm not sure, kind of run them all together, you know, Finland and Denmark and Sweden and stuff. But they have really long, like a year-long maternity leave and a long paternity leave, and they have subsidized child care. Mm. I mean, I guess the thing is you're not always worried.
Exactly.
One wrong move, and you're going to be, you know, in the little cabin, the little metal shack that Carl was describing along the riverbank.
Also, I don't think they worry quite as much. I'm not sure. I don't think they worry quite as much about the election results being overturned every 4 years in their presidential life. I don't think. I'm not totally sure, even though I think maybe they have prime ministers. I don't know.
Joe in Boston. What do you think, Joe?
Hi there.
Hi, Joe.
Hi,
we're running short on...
It's okay. Go ahead.
Hi there. We're running short on time. I think both of you are spot on with all the issues you've talked about, as well as the recent callers. One thing that hasn't come up is the extreme income and wealth disparity in the United States compared with other developed countries. And I think that unless and until... our government is willing to go after the tax code, we are going to see things get worse instead of better.
That's a great point. That's
a
good
one.
That
is a great
point.
And you know, if we just gave more agents to the IRS, what is it, trillions of dollars they could get from people that are really, really wealthy that are evading taxes. It would cover a lot of the programs that we kind of need. Do we have time for one more quick one? Cindy from Rhode Island.
20 seconds, Cindy.
What do you think, Cindy?
So I travel to Finland for about 3 weeks every year for the last 8 years, except for the COVID years.
And
you guys are spot on. There's just a different culture of community, of what it means to be a society and culture and support each other that I think definitely plays into the happiness factor.
Cindy, before you go, we haven't been to the Nordic countries. Most of them do have teeth in old age. Is that correct?
Oh, most of the time.
Most of the time. Thank you. Thank you for your call. By the way, we're making a lot. This is a disgrace that we're 15.
we're
considering the wealth in this country, it is
and
just
a disgrace. And
you've
got people in mile-long food lines in Chelsea. Because we can't help. Don't get me started.
What were you trying to say there?
There's nothing more for me to say.
You know what they do also? You know one of the reasons there's a lot of unhappiness in this country?
What's that,
people
Jim?
Playing loud music on the beaches.
Did
you know that?
I had a lot of supporters on the text message.
I don't think so.
If we only turned on the volume of the beach, everything would be fine.
Okay,
tomorrow we're going to be at the Boston Public Library. Yes, I
do.
We're going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. The Attorney General, Andrea Campbell, is going to be with us from 1 to 2.
Yep.
Our questions and yours. We're going to be with our tech authority, Andy Inocco. Good week to be talking to him. Our GBH's all-stars, Callie Crossley and media maven Sue O'Connell, will be delving into Gisele Bündchen's interview with Vanity Fair and what she had to say about her marriage to Tom Brady and whether she's really dating a jiu-jitsu instructor.
You're incredible. Really.
I want to thank
so cheapening the quality of the show.
Speak for yourself. Our crew, Zoe Matthews, Anne Conley.
Oh, here we go again.
Nicole Garcia.
Sorry, I'll stop.
Hannah Loss. Our engineers.
John Nicole Parker. And somebody else. Jamie's the boss or something. We got to go because we're really going to get fired or something.
Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow at the library.
Tomorrow.
See you. Bye.